Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
Paying too much for cable? Get Dish Network and get a special offer just for WRIF listeners. Two DVRs and an iPod. Call 866-897-4244. 866-897-4244. Or click for details.
To the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you so much. Welcome, everybody. Pleasure, as usual, to be with you. And got 2 hours of phone-in talk. Please join us. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. And joining me, as usual, Jalene Jordan. Hi, Jalene.
Hi, Peter.
How you doing?
I'm doing most excellent.
I love that. I don't know if everyone heard that, particularly people that are just tuning in right now. We just heard Us and Them from the Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon. What a stoner tune.
I felt it was quite perfect to lead into the Peter Werby Show. The mellow, you know, let's get everyone in a kind of balanced state.
There you go.
Well, then we can get them all riled up again.
the big story. Also, if you want to email us, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Hold on. I just want to turn your mic down for a minute. No, that's not doing it. All right. Just sounds a little weird. A
little weirdness? Okay.
You sound fine.
Okay, good. Well,
I sound weird. Maybe it's reflection of what's happening. Well, big demonstration in Washington, D.C. on Saturday. We learned two things. Tens of thousands marched, and Jane Fonda was with them.
Okay.
Those are the two main things, right?
That's all, yeah, on the mainstream news, when they gave the 15-second update, you know.
Really? Actually, NBC News on Saturday led with it, and it was very, very sympathetic coverage.
It's about time, then.
And ABC kind of buried it, but it was all, I thought, very, very positive coverage.
Good. I'm glad. You know, all I saw was basically the cable news, you know, CNN,
mm-hmm.
and the same thing that they do every single time, which is, you know, protesters marched on Washington today, la, 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 few photos. Yeah. It's over.
I don't think too many people are going to do this, but coincidentally, I just read this book. I thought I had just interviewed this woman recently, Lucy C. Barber, and the book was called Marching on Washington. It was the history of marches on Washington. And you think, whoa, wait a minute. Did they do that in 1801 or 1856? Actually, the first march on Washington, as we know it, happened in 1894 with something called Coxey's Army. These people were coming, trying to solve this depression that was going on, a horrible depression in the 1890s. It probably made the one in the 1930s look like a slight recession compared.
Really?
Yeah, it was really terrible economic times. And then it was that one. It was the suffragette march in 1913.
Of course, yes.
Something called the bonus march, where all these World War I veterans marched on Washington in 1932, and then they were, at the end, forcibly dispersed by General Douglas MacArthur.
Really?
Yeah, World War II.
So I wonder what the numbers, you know, were for these.
Right. Well, that's one of the things I wanted to talk about. Oh, by the way, if there's anyone listening that was at the march, we'd really like to hear from
please,
you.
Please, because, listen, I wiped a little tear. I was so sad not to be there.
Me too.
Ugh.
You had a good excuse. You had to work here at WRIF.
Well, yeah, I did, and I worked a lot.
I had some, not worth talking about, but I just couldn't go.
Couldn't make it.
No. And so, anyway, if you were there, I'd really like to hear from you. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. And I've been to tons and tons of those. Jalene has been to lots of them. But when you're at your first one, it's like, you know, the first time, I don't know, for a lot of things.
For a lot of things. We'll just leave it at that. And I took a good friend of mine, a younger guy, who had never been to Washington and was, you know, newly in the last few years. This was right before the last counter-inauguration.
Right.
I took him to that, and I gave him the rules, kind of the rules that you gave me of protesting, and basically how not to get arrested.
Yeah,
okay?
Also, never wear dangling earrings.
I didn't know that one, but I didn't wear earrings anyway.
Yeah,
so,
okay.
But you taught me well how not to get arrested. And what is this guy doing? What is this kid doing at the counter-inaugural? He's at the gates that they've put up, these big gates. And not only is he pounding with all of the other crazy ones, he is...
Wait. Those crazy ones are my friends.
Well, they're me, too. It's me, too, usually. But I'm trying to get this guy not arrested, okay? Mm-hmm. And he said later to a friend when we were having dinner, he said, well, how was the protest? He goes, oh, all I know is someone just kept pulling on the back of my coat the whole time. Because shortly after that, that's when the spray came out, Peter, and we all ran.
Oh, yeah. Well, so let's go back to the coverage. So
sure. It
said repeatedly, every account that I saw said tens of thousands of people were there. And people probably think, great, tens of thousands. How wonderful is that? And then at least by the third paragraph, it says that Jane Fonda was there. And then they were usually giving some space, either in the paper or time on TV, to the counter demonstrators. There were 40.
That was it.
And there were more people in line at the Port-a-Johns at any given Port-a-John than there were counter demonstrators that were pro-Bush, pro-war, and all that.
Now, wait a minute. In all fairness, aren't they supposed to, you know, show both sides?
I don't know if they're now. Let me tell you what United for Peace and Justice says. That's the umbrella group that sponsors it all. Now, this is going to seem to a lot of people listening like completely over the top. Now, all of the news accounts said tens of thousands were there. A couple said that they hadn't reached their projected goal of 100,000. Now, this is total BS. One of the things that these anti-war groups will never do is project a figure. They estimate that there were 400,000 people there.
That's right. And when you are at those marches, they have people organized,
right,
going around and taking and doing some. They have a method to count.
Two, three,
hardly
four. Yeah. And having been in demonstrations before, I was in a demonstration once in New York where there was a million people there, and they counted out as about 100,000 or something like that.
It's the biggest ruse.
But the MSM?
The MSM.
Yeah, that's a new one. Mainstream media.
Oh, ooh,
The MSM,
okay.
They always undercount this stuff. And I don't think there's any room for being indignant. I mean, that's their function, to misrepresent reality as far as I'm concerned.
That's a good point. And what happened? The police now have stopped counting.
They will, because they were always accused, righteously, of undercounting.
Yeah.
But let's get a little bit to Jane.
Sure.
Here's one description of the rally against the Iraq War. Here's the lead. Vietnam War protest icon Jane Fonda took the stage in her first anti-war demonstration in decades as tens of thousands massed to demand that Congress cut off funds for the Iraq War. She hadn't been at one in 34 years. So there's a couple
probably
of things.
Afraid to be.
If there were, some people are going, well, how do we know there was 400,000? I don't even want to go into that. I believe there was. Because I believe the integrity of the people that sponsored these marches. The government lies. Bush lies. People die. The anti-war movement doesn't do this. The movement for peace and social justice does not lie. Lying is the purview of government and the right wing. That's who lie repeatedly about everything. All right, so is there anything that is a lie in this sentence? Vietnam War protest icon Jane Fonda took the stage in her first anti-war demonstration in decades as tens of thousands. Well, we talked about the tens of thousands. Actually, there were hundreds of thousands in Washington on Saturday. Jane Fonda, this is in the lead. Say there was 90,000 there, that I'm totally wrong in my assumption. What percentage is, it's 1/90,000th of the amount of people there, and everyone else is kind of lumped into this huge mass. She's projected. Well, of course, she's a public figure.
Sure.
People have interest in her. You know, she was demonized. Rather than demonizing Nixon and the rest of these mass murderers and war criminals that carried out the Vietnam War, somehow Jane Fonda turns out to be the bad
Hanoi
guy.
Hanoi Jane.
Yeah. A lot of people went to Hanoi. I mean, the attempt was to make people understand that the United States, under Johnson and Nixon, had gone 10,000 miles from home and destroyed this country and killed 3 million people, and these people were not our enemy. That Richard Nixon was our enemy, was the enemy of peace, was the enemy of the American people, was the enemy of the American GI. Should I tell you what I really think?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, I'm going to hold back. All right, let's go back to the sentence. Vietnam War protest icon Jane Fonda. There were no icons.
Okay.
In fact, the movement was iconoclastic. It knocked over icons. I remember seeing Jane Fonda in Detroit.
What a good point, Peter.
Well, I mean, it's terrible writing for one thing, but Jane Fonda, when she took part in the GI movement, there was these series of coffee houses set up during the
early 70s. You told me about it.
Yeah,
and I can't think of it either.
What is it?
It'll come to you. I know.
How weird. GI support movement. Let's call it.
Okay.
So there were these coffee houses set up outside of army bases all across the United States because there was great ferment inside the armed forces themselves. There was hundreds of anti-war papers that were being published by active duty GIs in Vietnam and in bases in the United States. And these coffee houses were well attended, and they gave all sorts of advice and help and what have you, and tried to help the GIs make some sense of the same anti-war sentiments that they had that also the mainstream of the United States did at that time.
Were they quiet about it, as now?
No, there were active duty GIs that led every single anti-war march.
And this would be later on.
Yeah. Okay. And in fact, they're not supposed to do it in uniform. There were always a good couple hundred active duty uniformed GIs that would be at the head of marches during the Vietnam War. There was about... I do not want to exaggerate. There was a good number. Maybe someone knows that and can tell us. A good number of active duty GIs leading Saturday's march in Washington as well, but they were not in uniform, which is okay. That's all right now. I mean, okay in terms of the Army.
Right.
All right. So there were no icons then. Jane Fonda began during that period, like 1970, 71, who was this, babe. Who was in, what was that film, Barbarella
something
like that.
Yeah.
And so she was extraordinarily beautiful. She's still a very attractive older woman.
She sure is.
But she stopped wearing all makeup, cut her hair very simply, and said she just wanted to be one of the people.
What, today, you mean?
No, back then.
I'm like, what?
So she wasn't an icon.
Okay.
You know who the icons were? And I'll bet you don't know these. I mean, and that's understandable. But the Berrigan brothers, they were two Roman Catholic priests.
I do know the Berrigan brothers.
Sorry.
Absolutely.
And Dave Dellinger, who was even at that time an older man who was committed to nonviolence. And so if there were any icons, it was these soft-spoken,
faith-based, driven
people. And so Jane Fonda was not the icon.
How about Sean Penn? Now, that was the other one that they gave the other FaceTime to.
They gave him a lot of...
And basically, his main quote that we got, and hey, it's good. We like that Sean Penn, Sean Penn went to Iraq, to Baghdad, with our buddy Norman Solomon.
That's right.
Who I don't know if that means anything to anyone. But
Baghdad Sean.
That's right, Baghdad Sean, and it was a big deal. In fact, I think you and I were invited to go over on a couple of those, and I don't know. It was a time when it was easier to go over there.
Yeah.
Anyway, Penn says, in a democracy, we are the deciders.
Yeah. Well, he's the one that said that?
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, we got somebody actually on the line that went to the march. But
fabulous.
One other thing. So the 400,000 or the hundreds of thousands are reduced in the MSM, the mainstream media, to tens of thousands. And also, there was a support march in Royal Oak in front of St. Joseph's Church on Woodward at 11 Mile Road. And ABC News, Channel 7 in Detroit, gave it very favorable coverage.
Good.
And they said dozens march in Detroit. Okay. Now, there was about 150 to 200 people there.
Oh, that's pretty good.
It was very large. And so dozens, on one hand, they could say, well, you know, I can't even do the math in it. 12 would be 144. So about 15 dozen. But that's not the way you describe that many people. Dozens means how many? Three dozen, four dozen at the most.
Yeah, sure. Right. That's what I would think.
What proper language would be over 100 or over 150 people rallied in Royal Oak today in support of the mass march of hundreds of thousands in Washington, D.C.
You know, having been a television news reporter for an ABC station in another state, and having worked for the MSM at one point, right, you know what, they just don't think about that, the reporters. They don't sit there and really scientifically figure that out. They just kind of go, oh, what do you think? There's so little thought that goes into that. And when we sit here and lament over this, and why do they do this? You know what? They don't care, unfortunately.
Well, you know, sometimes yes, sometimes no. I don't want to get real conspiratorial, but the fact that this phrase, tens of thousands, is what they always use.
Every time,
with all the marches.
Every march, yes.
So, in New York, when I was there February 15, 2003, protesting the war that we knew Bush had lied us into, it hadn't begun yet, and there was about 1 million people. Same thing, tens of thousands of people. Well, yeah. Oh, well, all right. Wait a minute. I'm a sucker for people that are on cell phones. Let's get Eric on the air. Eric, hi. It's Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks, guys. How are you guys doing?
Doing great. How was the march?
Oh, man, it was great. It was my first time ever in D.C., my first major march like that. I literally just got off the airplane, hopped in my car, and I'm almost back to my place in Ann Arbor.
That's what I was going to do. I mean, I get a lot of these right-wingers say, yeah, you're always flying everywhere, polluting the atmosphere. But I'm with you, Eric.
That plane was going to go either way, you know, with me on it or not.
That's a good excuse. That's the one I use. Hey, did they say at the march itself how many people they thought were there?
You know, they didn't. I heard the United for Peace and Justice figure of 400,000, and I heard the traditional media figure of tens of thousands. And I'd have to say both are off, but that it's probably a lot closer to United for Peace and Justice.
Well, they used to say that you'll take the cops figure because they used to
tally.
They don't do it anymore. And they would take the protesters' figure and average it. But I don't buy that. I don't buy that.
Yeah, it was. You know, I've been in Michigan Stadium on football Saturdays with 110,000 people, and I can tell you it was a lot more than that.
Yeah, but it is pretty. What would you say?
It's overwhelming, first of all. Yeah. And there's so many offshoot groups, and you could just walk and walk and walk, and it's just group after group. You can just get lost in the greatness of it all. How was your experience?
Oh, it was amazing. Like I said, it was my first time ever at one of these kind of major protests and rallies. And I had heard going into it that there were going to be a lot of other groups with their side issues. But it seems like, for the most part, everyone kind of rallied around this central cause and let their own thing mostly go and say, you know, we got to get out of Iraq and don't even think about Iran.
Hey, did you go by yourself?
I actually met up with some people that I know through an online leftist blog community.
Okay. That's cool.
So
that's one of the reasons I didn't go is because I didn't have anybody to hook up with. Jalene was going to go, and then she had to work.
I've gone alone before, Peter. Come on.
All right. I should have. That's easy.
It's easy to make friends in an environment like that, too.
It is. Well, Eric, I'm glad you went. Thanks for giving us your experience.
Yep, thanks for letting me on the air, guys.
All right, glad to do it. Thanks for joining us.
313. I almost need a tissue, Peter. It was his first one.
298 WRIF. This is from Patty. Patty's listening in Bismarck, one of the Dakotas. Where is that? In North or South
Bismarck,
Dakota? North Dakota. Yeah. Shame you can't be there. Oh, this was before. We have a demo in Bismarck planned for those here that can't be in D.C. This from last week. Because she said, I am taking a very diverse group with me to D.C., a 20-year-old girl, a 6-year-old boy, a college professor, a gentleman who has never been anywhere or any kind of activist, and me who has gold marching boots from growing into it with my bros coming home from NAMM. Wow. If you think there would be any interest, I can send you the announcement for Biz Surge for Peace. I don't know. Have a great show. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Oh, that's wonderful.
What do you think about this as email? By the way, if you want to send an email, call talkyes@yahoo.com. This is from Matthew from Ann Arbor as well. When I listen to right-wing talk, such as Rush Limbaugh, it makes me want to hate. When I listen to you, Mr. Werby, it makes me want to hate myself. Which is better?
Okay. You know, you get some interesting emails over the years, and some who are just, people are just nasty, you know.
Well, was that nasty?
But no, this was a great it kind of made us laugh a little bit, and it wasn't hateful.
No, we get the same.
He just hates himself.
Yeah, yeah. I don't even answer hate mail. I used to always, you know, say that. What was my standard thing? Oh, yeah, get anger management.
Oh.
Actually, some guy did write, you know, just the string of abuse, and I said, well, there goes my argument. I was hoping you wouldn't bring up such rational rebuttals of my opinions.
You know, I think that it works better when you use a little better tone.
Well, I don't. Sometimes I've actually had people that I've written back and I've said, why do you, do you shout at people like this in your daily life?
Do you talk to your mother this way?
No, but I bet you a lot of these people talk to anybody below them that they think they're
subordinates.
They're subordinate. Their wife or girlfriend, their kids,
sure.
Their dogs, dog kickers. That's what I think they are. Yeah. Yeah.
With that.
I see one of these things with, all caps denouncing me, and I'm thinking, this guy kicks his dog.
Oh, no. That's a horrible thought.
And the other thing is that in all the years I've been doing this, I could probably count on one hand, and I wouldn't even need all my fingers, of the hate mail that's come from women.
Oh.
Angry men.
My gender. I'm so proud.
Yeah,
hey, Peter, who I thought we should get on tonight on this whole, on the show and maybe have live, but I didn't think of it till too late, bad producer, is John Conyers, because he spoke.
He did.
Yesterday, and we love our John Conyers. You know, anytime I've called him to be on the show, he says, anything for Peter Werby.
That's the congressman from Detroit. I saw him once at the Taste Fest down around the boulevard, and he just walks around by himself. He's now the head of the House Judiciary Committee. And
that's
I
right.
said, John, how you doing? And he said, shh, I'm incognito. I'm pretending I'm Harry Belafonte.
And, he has a sense of humor.
Well, I hope it was humor.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
He said one of his quotes that he told the crowd yesterday, George Bush has a habit of firing military leaders who tell him the Iraq war is failing. And then he looked out and shouted, he can't fire you.
Right.
I thought that was quite powerful.
And Sean Penn, we are the deciders.
That's right.
Yeah. By the way, can I find this quickly?
I'll talk about another vote, another group had a popular sign that was, I voted for peace. That's a good one. Peter. Listen.
I like the other one. You said you didn't know whether we should.
Well, there's a lot of them I should probably not repeat on the air.
All right, get the kids away from the radio.
What was the one about time to pull out, wish your daddy had?
You should pull out the way your daddy should have.
Yeah.
Right. But, one of the things about this, I am the decider,
we are the deciders?
Yeah, but no, but Bush saying, I am the decider, where it came from.
Oh,
the other thing he keeps talking about, how that he is our commander-in-chief. And Gary Wills wrote in, I don't think I sent you this one.
No, I did read this one.
Yeah.
Maybe you didn't.
He said, the president is not our commander-in-chief. He certainly is not mine. I am not in the army. And you go, whoa, wait a minute. What does that mean? It means that in the Constitution, the armed forces is headed by a civilian. I mean, you got to remember, I was saying this the other week about how this is this brilliant document for administering a government. No one had ever put together anything like this before. I mean, people look at the U.S. Constitution and say, when they're forming new countries or new governments, say, all right, we'll do one like this. There wasn't anything like that for the Founding Fathers as a model. Yet they understood perfectly the problems that governments create. I mean, governments are horrible things. And throughout their history, the last 6,000-8,000 years, they've been almost exclusively tyrannical. So they tried to pull the apparatus back a little. They haven't been totally successful. But the commander-in-chief is the civilian head of the military, because they did not want to have a military chieftain that was independent of popular control. So, but he is not commander-in-chief of us. He is not my commander-in-chief.
Yeah, that's what Gary Wills was saying in that. And he said the word commander-in-chief has become a synonym for president. And then I thought it was really interesting when he talked about Abraham Lincoln. When he took military action, he gave himself the proper title, which is commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States. It was then. And so now it's a completely different animal.
Now, speaking of a different animal, President George W. Bush's father accused the news media of, quote, personal animosity towards his son.
Oh, too bad. Before it was GW crying, he tried to kill my daddy, and now daddy's saying, oh, this
yeah.
is my poor
He got
kid.
So fed up with media coverage that supporters at the time, this was back him. Oh, he had problems with them, too. They said, annoy the media, real like Bush. Well, that didn't work. Let's go to our phones right here and welcome someone else. It's Lois, and she called 313-298-WRIF. And hi, Lois. You're on the air with Peter and Jolene. Hey.
Hi.
Hi, Lois.
How are you?
Good.
Good. A couple things I wanted to touch on. First off, Jane Fonda was disliked because she went to Hanoi and came back saying that the POWs were not being tortured, which they were. So that kind of blew her out of the water. Other than that, I have no problem with Jane Fonda. I'm glad she went. Blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
The other thing is that I work at a hospital that takes care of vets. I don't want to say which one because I'll probably end up fired. But the way we are treating the kids coming back from Iraq is just disgusting.
Do you see them?
Yes.
Okay.
And the way that they're getting cut up, well, some of them are being taken care of better than others, and I'm not quite sure why.
Uh-huh.
But,
Where's the biggest failings, Lois? I mean, what do you see?
Follow through. From what I'm hearing is, once they get through the system and they're taken care of, then they're dropped.
Well, they just fired, I guess the term is laid off, but they essentially just fired a number of caseworkers. And, you know, it's one of those things. I was going to bring this story, and now I don't have it, but somebody else may have seen it. Yeah, there are so many injured, 25,000 maybe at this point. And Hillary is saying, you got to end this by January 2009. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is going to go on for another 2 years. How many more people are going to be similarly maimed like that and not get proper care?
Well, and the other thing is that the people that are working overtime and stuff, we're not even getting paid like we're supposed to be anymore. So there's a lot of discourse with that.
What, you're a nurse, are you? A doctor?
I don't want to say what I do.
Okay.
A healthcare provider.
A healthcare provider.
There you go.
In the VA system, though.
Yes.
Okay. Cool. Yeah. One other thing I should say, normally when I hear a woman talking about hospital experiences, I should follow my own advice, it always is best to say, are you a doctor? Because she can always say, no, I'm a nurse.
Smart man.
On the other hand, if you say to a woman, oh, you're a nurse, and she says, I happen to be a surgeon.
How many men do you say, are you a nurse first?
Exactly.
Good point.
Exactly. I'm sorry, Lois, go ahead.
No, in the system, it doesn't matter.
Right, okay.
No, I'm not gender, I'm not, but I just find it, you know, and they moved the VA into the Defense Department now.
Uh-huh.
Where it used to be Interior, it is now in the Defense Department budget.
Huh. Well, there's...
put out there either.
Well, with all the damage that Bush has done to so many people, and, so many Iraqis, so many U.S. soldiers, it's incumbent upon us to take care of them the best manner possible, and that's not happening. I just have no idea how Bush could ever have gotten a reputation as being pro-military. It's absolutely ridiculous. All right, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Here is an email from Stephen in Dearborn Heights. And he wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Last week, Pete, you said public officials in the media always say there were tens of thousands of people at an anti-war, anti-Bush rally, even if there was obviously more than 100,000. And then he goes on to list all the headlines, say tens of thousands, tens of thousands, tens of thousands. And they also quoted the police at the rally as saying, quote, far less than were actually there. Why are they so fearful, Stephen asked, saying 100,000 or more attend any such protest? Because I don't know whether...
The reality of the numbers.
Yeah, I don't know. They don't want to be accused of promoting the opposition, the outside of the, the acceptable opposition, sure, yeah, which is all congressional. Course.
Yeah, there were a million men and women at the March for Women's Lives that I went to a few years ago, a million, and they still said tens of thousands.
Yeah, well, that's it. I guess that's their mantra.
Whatever, yeah.
Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan, we'll be right back with you. Carol, hang on. Ken, hang on as well. And if you want to join us, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. We'll have to talk about Ted Nugent, won't we?
Of course, we love to talk about Ted.
You're listening to WRIF.com. with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and joined by Jalene Jordan. Hi, Jalene.
Hello.
All right, we're talking about this massive 400,000-person demonstration that occurred yesterday in Washington, D.C. I know you heard tens of thousands, but...
Don't believe it,
yeah. Anybody that was there, I'd like to hear from you. Eric from Ann Arbor called us. I'd like to hear from you as well at 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Here's Carol. Carol's in Detroit. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. When you were doing a little walk down memory lane, I wanted to throw my hero in.
Who's that?
William Sloan Coffin.
Oh, yeah. Well, that would take a lot of explaining to people. Okay. Wasn't he, you know, he was at Yale the same time that Bush was there snorting all that cocaine and all that.
Oh, yeah. And also, I heard on one of these things where they mentioned, they said that he's already started this surge.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I actually have an article, a part of which I'm going to read a little later. Yeah, that has already happened. Yeah, there were a lot of heroes during the Vietnam War, and there weren't any icons, so I think that's important. There were people that, because that's what we should tell people, that a little earlier we were quoting from a news account that said Jane Fonda was a protest icon. This is such crap, such smears by the MSM, the mainstream media. Carol, thank you very much. Appreciate that. Here is Ken in Detroit. Ken, it's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, I was just listening, and the last caller worked at the VA and helped out vets.
Well, she worked at the VA hospital.
Or the VA hospital. First, I want to give her, you know, utmost respect because she's I'm a fellow reservist, and what she's doing for our guys coming back home is just outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my other thing is it just really upsets me the fact that some of these guys are doing 2 and 3 and 4 tours, whereas myself, I've been in 11 years and I haven't done one tour and I have volunteered.
What's that all about then? How come that's the case? I mean, you go over by units. You don't go over by individuals.
They ask for volunteers. My old units have actually, who wants to go, who wants to volunteer?
You're in the inactive reserves?
No, I am a reservist right now.
Huh. Well, I think, Ken, that if that's your desire, I suspect it will be met, because where they're going to get all the troops from is sure way beyond most people. But I don't know. I don't know what the hell a resolution of it all could be. But, yeah, a shout-out to those people that are doing the incredible work. Appreciate it.
There was
something
in one of the local newspapers this weekend about a young man who went back for his fourth tour, and he was part of this special that they ran. It was Band of Brothers, something like that. I know that was another movie and something like that. But, anyhow, went back for his fourth tour, and he just was killed.
So, oh, man.
Yeah. Well, horrible.
The odds.
Horrible.
I got to tell you, I got a neighbor with a son over there, good friends of ours in Florida who you don't know, live on, you know, the Gulf Coast. They have a son in the Marines. And,
yeah.
You know, there's
a friend's
brother.
Just,
yeah, there was, let's see, actually something was going through. Oh, yeah, I think they think 1 million people have gone, military. 1 million military personnel have gone through Iraq already. 4 years.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. But, leading the march were active duty GIs, the big hundreds of thousands in Washington. Then they had all these veterans of Iraq, including the Iraq Veterans Against War and veterans of other wars and just veterans. And then they had military families, because there's a group called...
The Gold Star families?
That's one of them. Gold Star are people like Cindy Sheehan have lost children
there.
But there's also just military families, and I can't remember the rest of it. If you go on my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com, you can
it's not
hook
Voices
up with that.
In the Wilderness, is it?
No.
Okay.
That's Kathy Kelly. But here, this is Ron and Warren, and Ron helped organize the buses. Ron, hi. It's Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Jalene.
Hi.
Hi.
And we had three buses from Detroit. We had wonderful Spirit in Washington, and we, best of all, we had wonderful weather. It was almost like a spring day.
Wow.
Very lucky, because those could be brutal when it's cold.
The upside of global warming.
Yes, and the spirit was phenomenal. Just as you say, Peter, when you invite people to go there, you have to go to be part of something like this to realize what the spirit is.
Now, I don't think I don't want to spend a lot of time on the numbers game, but Ron, did you get any idea of how many people were there? Was any kind of people that put it on, the United Peace, United for Peace and Justice? Did they?
I never heard any number there, but just comparing it to the many that we've been to before, it was huge, and I think 400,000 would be very close to what it was.
Yeah, that's you know, years ago, back in the day, I went to a demonstration in New York against the Vietnam War, and it was a march from Central Park that began at noon and marched to Dag Hammarskjöld Plaza at the United Nations. And the cops measured how many people at one, and the rally was supposed to start at 1 p.m. So at 1 p.m., they dutifully took an aerial photograph and had this way. They counted everybody and came up with there was 110,000 people there. And they said, hey, here's the photograph. The only thing they didn't mention was that from 1 p.m. till 5 p.m., people were stretched all down Fifth Avenue and filling a good part of the section of Central Park. And the estimate was, and that's what I was talking about, there was actually a million people there, and there was 900,000 people that were just disappeared from taking
part.
That
photo,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, that they weren't there. So they have their ways of counting. Now, Ron, you said that we sent three buses. Who's the we here?
Well, this was Detroit Area Peace and Justice Network, and I would say mainly coordinated by Peace Action members. And Sigrid was the main organizer. Everybody had to contact Sigrid. You've talked about her often, and you have even, interestingly enough, to talk to her on the air when she wasn't even on the phone. That was cute.
Okay, that's great. All right, and are you guys still doing that vigil near your headquarters in Ferndale every Monday?
That vigil is still going on. Not everybody is part of it that that you have spoke to many times, for example, at Women in Black, but there are still faithful people that come regularly.
All right, that's, what is it, 4:45?
Yes, it's an hour long.
4:45 to 5:45 at the corner.
At 9 Mile and Woodward.
All right. Jolene, should we go tomorrow?
Yes, actually.
Okay. Ron, thank you so much.
You're welcome,
Peter.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
All right, let's talk to our pal. Let's not, well, it would be nice to talk to him, but let's talk about our pal, Ted Nugent. As he says in one of his songs, when in doubt, I whip it out.
We could go on and on with the lyrics. And then his book, his highly acclaimed cookbook,
Kill It and Grill It, right. Well, here's what's happening, in case you didn't mention this. It says, rocker Ted Nugent says Texas Governor Rick Perry had no problem with the musician's decision to wear a Confederate flag T-shirt during the inaugural ball. This was a few days ago. Nugent said Governor Perry, even complimented his performance and talked to him backstage and said, greatest rock and roll. Nugent, using machine guns as props, that's always pleasant, shouted some remarks about non-English speakers during his performance that were offensive to some in the audience. Nugent said the governor also called over the weekend, ending the conversation by telling the entertainer, give him hell. Governor Perry's spokesman, Robert Black, said the governor wouldn't personally wear such a shirt. Oh, well, gee, that's good to know. It's good to know that a Southern governor won't wear a Confederate flag T-shirt, just as A-hole from Michigan will.
Yeah.
He told the singer he has the right to wear whatever he wants. What would if he would have come with a swastika?
That's true.
Yeah.
But we do have to talk about the freedom of expression, okay?
Well, yeah.
You know? I mean, I have some pretty offensive T-shirts. I do.
Like what?
Well, you know, I don't want to talk about them here.
Oh.
I can't say those words.
Oh, man.
I know.
Right.
So, and we know a lot of people who have offensive T-shirts, or what some would consider offensive.
Here's the deal.
I don't consider them offensive.
Here's the deal with the new Joe. This is an official event.
And I'm not supporting him, by the way.
No, I know.
Okay.
I mean, first off, if someone came to my house, and I know there's a difference, it's not a public event. I wouldn't let anybody in my house with a swastika on or a Confederate flag or anything like that. Now, Some people just think, oh, it's kind of rebellious. But underlying it, no matter what anyone says about it, is pure racism. It is the symbol which is flown always by the Ku Klux Klan, by Nazis when they rally. Gary Bledsoe, president of the Texas chapter of the NAACP, criticized Nugent wearing it, saying it symbolized, quote, the enslavement of African Americans and more recently the symbol of hate groups and terrorists. Now, does anybody deny that? I mean, maybe you got it on the front of your truck, you know, and maybe you say, hey, I'm not a terrorist and I don't hate anyone. But that is what it is the symbol of. You can have a swastika and say it's a South Indian symbol, which it is. Different, the swastika is backwards. But, you know, it's pretty pretty clear what it all means. And the idea that... that he is making remarks about non-English speakers. This guy's in Texas? Texas? I don't know what his ethnic background is, but when my people came over here, they didn't speak any English.
I know. And he did reiterate.
How about your people? You didn't,
my people don't know?
Yeah.
They didn't.
Right, right. Well, you know, he is a pendejo cabrón grande.
Ooh, that's not nice.
No. Well, he wouldn't understand it either because he would complain that
because he's not bilingual or multilingual.
Yeah, I guess. Right. Yeah. You know, he and talk about and you know, he's really kind of maneuvering to become the head of the NRA, the National Rifle Association, taking what's his name?
Old Charlton?
Charlton Heston's place, and I think he is the Nuge has like an early onset of what has been troubling Charlie.
Dementia.
Yeah, I mean he's out of his mind. But it is so repulsive and so offensive to wear a Confederate flag.
To wear the shirt.
And how about this? Perry was sworn in. This is the governor sworn into office and spoke of bipartisanship, compassion for the poor, and racial and class unity. And this man, Ray, you know, anybody that's, you know, you perform your music in person, right? Mm-hmm. And you make a real, you've never told me this, but I know any performer. And like when I go out like to bar gigs, when I've done that, I think, how am I going to look and how am I going to be perceived, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Right.
You put on a show, you want an, you know, audience reaction, that whole thing.
So he purposely, because he's going, you know,
purposely wore the shirt.
Yeah, because he's playing for Republicans that still have a base in racist whites in Texas that feel overwhelmed with the darker skinned people.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah. They're, and that's a white state. Oh, yeah, that's right. They stole it from the Mexican nation, didn't they? Right. Whatever. That was a long time ago. Come on, let it go. But
move on.
But in any ways, it was purposely provocative. And the fact that the governor of a state wouldn't say, hey, you're out of here, dude.
Yeah, change the shirt
because
you're not performing.
Because either I am honest in what I say about compassion for the poor and racial and class unity, or that's just a lot of words, and I'm a terrible hypocrite, and I'm going to let this man with this absolutely offensive symbol continue on.
You know, that is a great point. And you know how some of the war protesters, like Cindy Sheehan or Madea Benjamin from Code Pink, where they have infiltrated some of these press conferences with you know, a sign, a big sign, not just a T-shirt, and they get thrown out, yet this, you know.
That's interesting. Yeah, and they usually have signs calling for peace or understanding or
ending
what have
the occupation.
So here is this man who
moved to Crawford, Texas, for crying out loud.
Also, what a moron, because he moved there when this right-wing revolution, this far-right radical revolution was at its height. Oh, yeah, I'm gonna go there. And so now the whole bottom of it's dropped out. Bush is despised by 70% of the population, understandably so. And he's down there. You know,
hanging in Crawford. You know, I think part of the reason that he moved there, I think he loves Bush so much and he wanted to be close to his home. But I also think that he hates Michael Moore so much. Remember when Michael Moore went down and he set up a big movie theater and they showed Fahrenheit 9/11 down there?
I didn't know that. That's
yeah,
cool.
He put up a big outdoor movie. And he thought, well, if Michael Moore can do it, I can do it too. In fact, I can do it better. I can live there.
Well, that's good. That's good.
Bye.
Bye. Yeah, you look good going. Let the door.
And we'll still play you on 101 WRIF.
Yeah. Let the door hit you in the ass. Here's Aaron in Southgate. Aaron, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hi, how's it going? I was calling because I was want to comment on your remarks earlier that comparing the Confederate flag to the swastika. I just find it interesting that you would compare such two radically different symbols, because although I think it's a great shame that the Confederate's flag has been digressed into such a symbol that people take it as a racist symbol, I don't believe that everyone who wears it or shows it means it as a racist symbol, because I think the swastika, no matter how you put it, is racist and horrible, but a Confederate flag was originally flown by Southern troops. That was their battle flag.
Well, I was going to say, for one thing, it's a battle flag, and they tried to kill my great-great-granddaddy.
Oh, hey, if Bush
like
can
Bush.
Say it.
Yeah, they did, yeah.
No, I think you weren't making necessarily a direct comparison.
Yeah,
you were
it was
an example, wasn't it? Okay.
Direct comparison. Yeah, I was out at Woodmere Cemetery at the Grand Army of the Republic burial site, and there my great-great-great-whatever, Red Bigham.
Really?
Of the Michigan 117th Volunteers or something like that.
No, he was kind of a famous dude, wasn't he?
No.
There's a story behind
him. Just among a lot of women in Detroit at the time, but not
nice.
In any. Now, I'm however you want to slice it, Aaron, now they are co-equal, and the groups that fly them understand what its not-so-coded message means. So why I don't know why you're defending it. Hey, the Confederates were the greatest traitors in American history, right?
Well, here's the thing, though, is that half these people who went into battle flying this flag didn't even own slaves. They were too poor to own slaves.
Oh, yeah, they're a bunch of suckers, that were off fighting. I mean, it's like most wars, like this one. It's a rich man's war, and it's a poor man's fight. And these guys, if they would have had any brains, they would have made common cause with slave revolts, overthrown the slavers and the plantation owners. And what was that guy's name in Gone with the Wind? Reb or Jeb or?
Rhett Butler?
Rhett Butler. And sent Rhett Butler getting an honest job and set up some decent interracial society. So screw that flag. Thank you, Aaron.
That's a common argument when this whole Confederate flag issue comes up. That is the one of the, several things that is brought up. And so I kind of expected that reaction. But I think it's really time to kind of look at it for what it really is.
Well, what if you
had, what it represents to an entire sect of people.
If this show was in South Carolina, people would talk about the heritage and maybe that it was a bad thing. Well, whatever. I mean, made every excuses. But now it has only one reaction on people who were the most directly affected by it, and that's people of African origin. And why would you want to wear or fly something or display something that is so offensive,
hurtful,
and remembrance of an awful, disgraceful time in American history? People always say this is a free country. Well, the slave trade, not just slavery, but the slave trade was allowed under the Constitution that I was just saying was this wonderful document. They allowed the legal importation of slaves up until 1803. And then we had to fight a war to dispossess this nation, this so-called democratic nation, of being a slave state, right? And people want to fly the symbol of that, these traitors who were going to destroy the American government in order to maintain us as a slave state or have a separate slave state. Yeah, burn that flag.
Can't get behind it.
Burn that flag.
Still can't. You know, when I see that on cars and things like that, I automatically kind of get my chest kind of tightens up. I get a little bit of anxiety, you know.
I think, this guy kicks his dog.
No, come on, Peter. That's like your whole mentality about it's only Republicans who don't pick their dog's poop up.
I think that's true. And then they kick them.
Oh, God. Okay.
Let's get this call real quickly. And Stan from Garden City. Stan, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air. Hi.
Good evening, everybody. How are you doing?
Doing good.
Okay. I just want to make it quick. The non-binding resolution that the senators are up debating right now, why is it non-binding? Why can't they make it binding for a stronger kick in the president's face? And it seems like it's just carte blanche, a worthless piece of paper. Can you explain that, number one?
Yeah, there's finalists. They do not have the intestinal fortitude to take on the Bush concept of the imperial presidency. I mean, it'd be one thing. I mentioned this, I think, before, this analogy. When you talk about the empire, the Rome, when it went from being a democracy to an empire, they started off with people like Caesar and then finally degenerated into the Neros and Caligulas and what was that other madman? But we're starting off with that. The first imperial president turns out to be an incompetent whack job.
Right. I want to also say about the Confederate flag, what you're debating right now, and wrap it into an argument of Ted Nugent. Everybody loves Ted Nugent's music. That's a given. But the man himself, yes, he is a hypocrite. But the Confederate flag itself, it was a defeated flag. Was it honorable? Well, maybe to them people back then who died for the cause. But I'm looking at the Confederate flag with the same emphasis as the American flag. What's going to happen if these troops are withdrawn from Iraq? Is it going to be the same gravitation of a defeated purpose? And what's going to happen? Good night.
Good night. Who knows? That's the problem. I mean, that Bush has created the situation where...
around the world, when people see that flag.
What is going to happen? I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. All right. We'll be right back. Some open lines for you. 313-298-WRIF and 313-298-9743.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
those guys.
The hell with that.
Don't say it!
Maui Time 2007,
presented by Budweiser.
Just keep your radio locked on 101 WRIF.
When you hear Big Daddy shout those three magic words, you could win the ultimate getaway.
Ready for some fun in the sun?
A week-long trip for two to the sun and surf of Kaanapali Beach in Maui with your host with the most, a big kahuna, Arthur Pithallow.
Maui Time 2007. Listen and win. Exclusively from Budweiser. This is beer and your official Maui Time station, 101. WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Baby.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and joined by Jalene Jordan for our second hour of Night Call. Please join us, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. A lot of emails coming in. Call talkyes at yahoo.com. I or Jalene or both of us read every one, and we can't read every single one on the air, though. Our friend Roy out in
Mexico.
Yeah, do you remember the...
It was
Placento.
No, it was Plegas?
Never mind.
Placento. I don't think there is such a thing.
Placito. The town where Nugent lives, Pendejo Cabron. So we were talking about the anti-war demonstration in Washington and how the numbers were severely reduced, all the reports at tens of thousands, and in fact, probably was around 400,000. Also, this focus on Jane Fonda, who was this infinitesimally small part of it all, but just the way they try to smear it. Well, Roy Placito, I think it is.
Placito. I had the P-L-A-C-E, right.
Placito, New Mexico.
Sorry.
When Jillian and I did our nationally syndicated show, we were out in New Mexico a couple of times, out in, what's the big...
We were in Santa Fe.
Thank you.
Woo. Yes.
Yeah, lovely. Let's see, this is good. Roy says, we had probably 800 to 1,000 people in Albuquerque on a day that started out cold and foggy, but by noon was a great New Mexico Chamber of Commerce day. Bright sun, 50 degrees, even though it was Saturday. We went to Heather Wilson's office, the Republican representative out there. And
she's a treat.
Yeah. His sign said, support the troops, impeach the son of Bush. And the other side said, this vet demands impeachment. All right, give him hell, Roy, and keep tapping. Yeah.
And great numbers there in Albuquerque. Right on.
Mark says, I'm a retired former New Yorker. What does that mean? Who has been living in a vacuum here in New Jersey for the past 20 years. As such, I'd believe the Christian evangelicals were a quaint minority who few mainstream Americans didn't take seriously. Or most, I think he means most, didn't take seriously. But tonight I saw Alexandra Pelosi's documentary. The daughter of, Speaker of the House.
And Nancy Pelosi, right?
On, HBO, did Friends of God, and it scared the poop out of me. These evangelicals are potentially a dangerous cult, says Mike.
Well, and I missed this. This is Friends of God, a road trip with Alexandra Pelosi. It is on again for anyone who wants to catch it. Tuesday, this coming Tuesday at 1:30 p.m. and 10 o'clock p.m. If you have TiVo, if you're lucky enough to have that.
Mm-hmm.
Tuesday, 1:30 p.m., 10 o'clock p.m., and it's real interesting stuff. I mean, I haven't seen it, but I've read this article, and it goes in to old Ted Haggard, our old reverend buddy. And
Who is having gay sex and enhancing it with
methamphetamine.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, which he denies that part. He does.
He does?
Yeah, he said he bought it, but he never did it. It's kind of like Clinton not inhaling it, all right?
Eric from Southgate writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Just watched Friends of God on HBO. Very disturbing and scary. This nation is in trouble with this religious nonsense. Your thoughts on religion, again, I enjoy hearing your views. Oh, I'm going to let it have it in just about a minute. But what did that make me think? Oh, yeah. This article in the New York Times says, Tiller was removed from his ministry last November for sexually immoral conduct. He was accused of having sex with a male prostitute and buying illegal drugs. The Reverend Ted Haggart was the president of the National Association of Evangelicals and one of the most prominent spokesmen for the Christian right. And also, he was featured in this one of the documentaries that's up for an Academy Award called Jesus Camp.
And oh, you have you seen that?
Yeah, I interviewed the one of the co-directors. Is from the Detroit area.
Well, I don't know if looking forward to seeing it is the right way to put it. I haven't seen it.
Actually, before you came back on the show, I hosted a showing of it at the main theater in Royal Oak. But now Mr. Haggart, they you know, in the New York Times, they always give titles. So now it's Mr. Haggart. He's been stripped of his vestments. Waggishly told the documentary filmmaker a few months before his secret came out, "You know, all the surveys say that the evangelicals have the best sex life of any group. What is with this guy?"
Oh, then, did you see after that? He tries to coax a member of his congregation to say how often he has sex with his wife. Every day, twice a day. And how often she climaxes every time.
You believe him?
Ted Haggart, no.
No, of course not.
I can't think of anything nice to say, so I'm going to do what my mama told me and say nothing at all.
Right. I mean, this is... that twice a day, this, you know,
what?
We've talked about this before. The two things that people lie the most about in surveys is sex and religion.
Oh.
And people always exaggerate both, how many times, how religious they are and how many times they attend church and almost how much sex they have. So a lot of these people, that's all they do is go to church and have sex.
Right on.
And have orgasms. That's really nice. Let's go back to our phones. 313-298-WRIF. Anybody... did you go to the march? Like to hear from me. If you saw the coverage on television, like to hear about that as well, your impressions. 313-298-WRIF. This is Fernanda in Bloomfield Hills. Hi, Fernanda. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Is this my pal, Fernanda?
It's your pal, Fernanda.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, how are you?
Good. Did you go to the march?
Yes, we did.
You know,
Gregory and I went to the march, and I looked for you everywhere.
You know what, Fernanda? If you got to give me a call. I would have gone if I would have known you were going.
You would have gone? That would have been great.
I swear to Gaia.
Okay, well, it's going to be another one in February and another one in March.
Okay. Wow.
We still have time to do it. It was absolutely fabulous.
Was. Give me some impressions. You know, it sometimes is not real easy to express the feelings beyond sort of just that statement that it was fabulous or it was overwhelming. And you say, why, to somebody, and they go, well, it was.
It's hard to explain. I would like to ask you how the police presence was there.
It was, actually, my impression was that it was very, very minor, and it was interesting because they were park police. I personally saw very few D.C. police.
Yeah, see, you know, I think they've kind of gotten used to we peace people. I mean, I remember Peter and I marching in Miami when they shut down the city, spent $8 million to protect them from Peter and I and a bunch of monks, okay? You know, I mean, I think they figured it out that the raging grannies aren't going to do anything too crazy.
That's right.
Yeah, and of course, the crowd of people there was just a huge array of people. One thing I did notice that I thought was great is the large number of young people. I mean, younger than us.
Good.
And that there is, you know, there is a peace movement amongst the young. And I've talked to a lot of people there my age and older than me, and that was a real, really encouraging thing to see. And you're right, you cannot, I'm sort of at a loss for words as to how to describe the feeling.
Well,
and the spirit.
Well, I think it is because it has a spirit that's overwhelming, and if you are precise about the word overwhelming, it does that. I mean, I've talked to people that say that they would be there and they'd start crying.
Easily.
And you know what I think it is in it for one thing, it is as I've said before the French and Italian and Spanish word is closer to manifestation, manifestación. That's how they in Europe refer to what we call demonstration. And it manifests the kind of outrage and the kind of the coming together of people that believe similarly, so that you don't have that feeling of isolation, that you're not, again, this word, overwhelmed by the MSM, the mainstream media that just that for years repeated every lie of this, you know, of the rulers and their official explanations and all that. So it is good to go to these things, and I know you've been to a lot of them.
Yeah.
But if you haven't, go to the next one, people. Don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. And it was great to give my 13-year-old son the opportunity.
That's great.
And the legacy. Yeah. I mean, it's just
we'll
be going to more.
Let's get in touch.
Okay, we will, Peter.
Thank you for
tonight. Having.
Yeah.
Bye.
Yeah, I really do love seeing the younger folks. They're very inspiring.
Fernanda used to be the local secretary, and that's the head in our case of of our union, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Yeah. So
she's royalty.
Right. Here's Chris in Ferndale. Chris, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hi, yeah, I just wanted to say, first of all, I'm a big fan of your show.
Thank you.
I listen to you guys almost every week, every chance I get. I wanted to say the whole Confederate flag issue, that reminds me of something, a discussion I've been having with a lot of people lately. It's how much that reminds me very much of actually the Bible, believe it or not. I recently read a survey that somebody was given to about a dozen or so Israeli school children about the genocide of the Armalites, I believe is what they were called.
Don't know.
And I guess the survey was given to these children, and they said that it was justified for, you know, the Armalites' lack of faith. And the same review was given back to the children, but all the names were changed to Hitler and a lot of Nazi party members of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, they considered that wrong. Now, I see the symbolism as being the same as the Confederate flag, because in many ways it all depends on how you look at it, you know. Because,
well, wait a minute. It depends on who the you is in this case. And it's an extraordinarily offensive sign to some people. You know, you never should be wedded to symbols. And that's one of the reasons that so many people are messed up in this country, because they're addicted to symbols. And, I mean, actually, I have Southern relatives who is a branch of the family. In fact, my great aunt used to insist that we were related to the Lees of Virginia, including Robert E. Lee. So I could legitimately say part of my heritage is the Confederacy, and I could display a Confederate flag not because I believed in slavery, but because I was proud of the lineage of my family. And then I would think, wait a minute, that's not the way people are going to interpret it. They're going to see that as a purposely offensive symbol of racism, to say we're not accepting this country's march towards tolerance, but rather we want to say, screw you. I want to hold on to these terrible, divisive, racist views. So you can slice and dice it any way you want, but there's no reason to offend people on such a level as that. And I'll tell you, most people display it because it is offensive. That's my opinion. All right, thank you, sir. Appreciate you calling in. You know, I want to get this on just real quickly. So, Chris, I want to hear from you about gas prices, and Tim's calling from Ann Arbor about the Confederate flag as well. 313-298-WRIF and 313-298-9743. Oh, yeah. Hey, stay up. We're going to talk. This seems like it was like months ago, the sorry State of the Union speech that Bush gave.
Oh, last week.
Yeah. Well, no. Well, this last Tuesday.
Yeah.
Doesn't it seem like eons ago?
Yes. Well, you mean when all he wanted to talk about was health care?
Yeah.
Okay.
And how he's going to tax people with good health care.
Yeah.
Well, Bill Hartung, who's been on the show a lot from the World Policy Institute, is going to talk about that. And also Peter F. Smith, who's head of the CEO, or COO, rather, of Joe Kennedy's organization, which distributes discounted Citgo fuel oil to low-income families in the country, including Michigan. And if you, by the way, if you have make under a certain amount, and it's not that low, you may be eligible to get like a one-time grant. Peter Smith, who actually is friends with Peter Smythe, who's the head of our radio group. Or that's actually, right. I think he's now, isn't he, president of the company, the whole company? Yeah.
Yeah, Greater
Media. So Smith and Smythe hanging out.
So you can get a grant for gas from Citgo. They'll help you.
Fuel oil. All right, but here, I want to play a little music. This is our friend David Rovix, but this is going to be about 60 seconds, so don't go away.
We've got a situation, and it calls for a solution that upholds our domination of the planet. We're going to make our peace, and we're going to make it well. And if you don't like our logic, you can can it. We'll use impeccable intelligence from any country in the world, as long as we all see eye to eye. If we don't find quite what we need, we know what to do. Just look into the camera and lie. It's Operation Iraqi Liberation. Tell me, what does that spell? Operation Iraqi Liberation. O-I-L. We'll lie about the missiles and the nuclear research. We'll lie about uranium. We'll build military bases and smile for reporters as we give away bubble gum. We'll lie about Bin Laden, his connections with the Saudis. We'll lie about 9-1-1. We'll lie about the fascists, their connections to Al-Qaeda, because we know there's none. It's Operation Iraqi Liberation. Tell me, what does that spell? Operation Iraqi Liberation.
That's the music of David Rovix, R-O-V-I-C-S, and go to davidrovix.com. So that's an older song. And
he did that several years ago.
Yeah, so why did I play it now? Now, that was actually what these morons in the Pentagon called the first, instead of they changed it to Operation Enduring Freedom.
Yeah.
But initially they called it Operation Iraqi Liberation. Someone said, hey, you fools, that spells oil. And that's what everyone says this is about. Now, this is from this week on Thursday. Iraq's prime minister told Parliament Thursday that the coming U.S.-Iraqi security sweep in the capital would be a battle against militants who he said would not be safe anywhere in the country. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki did not give the details of the plan, which he has dubbed Operation Imposing Law. What does that spell?
O-I-L.
These people, what a piece of work. All right, so where are we going here? Oh, yeah, let's talk to Chris in Allen Park about gas prices. Chris, it's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air. Hi.
Hey, good evening.
Thanks for joining us.
Hey, no problem. I'm joining you every week, man. I work midnight. I get to hear Julian a lot because they throw her on the night shift.
Oh, yeah.
Placer.
That's where I like it.
Position, not thrower.
Anyways, you didn't said anything about gas prices. It seems to me that over by my house, gas prices have shot up about 20 cents since the auto show ended. And it was kind of like my wife was saying the same thing you were saying. Like they're trying to lure people in, like, hey, go ahead and buy that new SUV or something, you know?
Yeah.
And the auto show ends, and then, bam, gas prices are going back up.
I'll tell you, Chris, right on the block over here by WRIF, the Fast Track, it had gone down to $1.89. And now it's $2.19, so that's what, 30 cents in
30 cents in a week, because last week we were talking about that. And also, well, you know, the sorry State of the Union speech was given, and that scares the holy bejesus out of people. And every time that guy speaks, the gas prices go up, wouldn't you say?
Well, they've always tried to raise them, but now, apparently, Cheney's got this deal where he's going to talk to his buddies, the Saudis, and get them to increase production so it would drive the price down and deny, like, Iran and Venezuela the income that they're using for.
Well, let's
whatever.
Keep making Iran as mad as we can.
Yeah, that's a good idea. All right. Thank you so much, Chris. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Tim. Tim's in Ann Arbor. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hi, I was calling about the Confederate flag. I came from Alabama. My whole family lived down there. My grandpa flew the flag in the yard.
Yeah.
So growing up, it kind of means different for me and for a lot of other people that, I mean, that's my heritage. That was my grandpa had it, you know, family had it. And nobody was prejudiced, you know, nobody hated on anybody or anybody
Well, wait a minute. During the 1960s, I think the 50s and the 60s, states like Alabama and Georgia and a number of others placed the Confederate battle flag on their state flag. And they did it, Tim, for only one reason, to show their opposition to integration and their opposition or their support for segregation. And everybody always used to say, we don't hate our colored folks. We all get along and all that. And it was a load of crap.
You know what? There's a lot of internalized racism that a lot of us who don't really outwardly consider ourselves racist, like me, that is really there that we just don't know about. So, you know, I don't know. I'm not calling you a racist by any means.
Yeah,
oh, but I do have our caller.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to ask you, do you display that here in Michigan?
No, I don't.
Okay.
That's what I was saying. My family. I'm not talking about everybody in Alabama.
Right. Okay.
Because racism is everywhere. I'm talking
sure.
about
There's good folks
family.
In Alabama. Who said that?
You know,
who sang that?
Oh, yeah, there really is.
Kid Rock?
No. No, that's a Leonard Skinner line.
Oh,
honestly.
Damn
but
me.
They, I'm talking about, you know, from my family's point of view, it's always been, well, Grandpa had one, you know, so, you know, we've kind of always kind of related the flag to my grandfather.
Well, you know,
generation.
Sometimes, I tell you, things do get separated from its origin. I'll buy that. I'll let it go.
Yeah, boy, my grandpa,
thank you,
who has gone to the great wherever in the sky, he had some beauty things to say that I would never repeat, that's for sure.
Yeah.
You know, it was that generation.
Yeah, it was.
At least for him.
What is the greatest generation, except when it came down to the 50s and 60s. They didn't act so great then. Here's Sarah. Sarah, it's Peter and Jalene. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Detroit.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, I just have something to say about the whole Confederate flag thing. You know, every year we host this wonderful event called the Hoedown, and every year it seems that people bring their Confederate flags, and, of course, the Detroit police are always surrounding it. Well, majority of your Detroit police officers are going to be African American.
Right.
And you got to keep in mind that these people are saving lives. You know, why would you want to do something to offend them? I can understand that people are symbolizing this to their past and the history and whatnot, but if it's something that is so strongly offensive to somebody else, why wouldn't you put yourself in that situation and say to yourself, you know what, I don't think I would like to feel that way if I was in that situation, so I'm not going to do it to somebody else.
Sure. I mean, I think that's the way to look at it. The other thing is the rise of country music in popularity always occurs when there's a very popular form of black music. And like in the 70s, when all of a sudden disco and all that came, that was another time of resurgence of country music. And now with rap dominating, all of a sudden as well, it's sort of white people's
Toby
music.
Toby Keith.
Yeah, I don't want to. Now look at last time, and people began calling in droves, telling me about all the progressive country people. And there's an African American friend
of mine.
The only
ones are the Dixie Chicks.
No, there's tons of them. No,
I'm just kidding.
Yeah, no.
I'm just kidding.
There's an African American friend of mine. I was talking to him on Martin Luther King Day at the rally down at Central Methodist Church, and he told me I was all wet and that he was going to take me to a country concert and all that.
You're all wet.
Well, he said that is not all racist music.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much. Here, let's go to Sean. He's from Grand Rapids, but he's driving home from the D.C. march right now. Sean, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Where are you? Where are you on the trip?
Oh, let's see. I'm passing right now Perry.
Perry, Ohio?
No.
Perry, Michigan.
Yeah.
Oh,
how many Jolt colas have you had so far?
Yeah. I'm hanging in there. I've had a few rock stars.
Yeah, that's what it is these days.
Kind of dated myself.
So you went to the march?
I was there. It was amazing.
Yeah.
And the kind of another word you guys were describing, some words to explain it, empowering.
Yeah, that's
it was powerful. There was people everywhere. As far as the eye could see, people in the streets singing, dancing, you know, doing the right thing.
People
yeah.
doing every kind of thing you can imagine in protest of this war, really.
Sean, did you go? Are you with people now as you're driving?
Yeah, me and my roommate made it down, and like I said, we're just heading back.
Well, there's a big anti-war movement in Grand Rapids. You guys always turn out more people than Detroit does at local demonstrations.
Yeah, and I've been to a few of those, and when I found out about this one in D.C., I figured that it was our time to go. So.
No, that's good. First one?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
How far of a drive is that? Anyway.
It's about a 10-hour drive.
That's not bad.
He's driving pretty fast.
Yeah.
So it's 15 about, for me.
Well, from Detroit to Washington, it's about 9.5 hours and
okay.
45 minutes.
That's not too bad.
No.
Well, you know, we are from Michigan, so we do drive a little faster.
Yeah. You gotta watch out about Ohio, though.
Did you carry a sign?
I did not. Okay. I took a ton of pictures, though. I got about 350 pictures of everything.
No, well, send us a few.
Oh, yeah. Pick a few and email to Peter's, which one?
Call talk yes at yahoo.com. Well, welcome back, Sean. I'm glad you went. I feel increasingly badly I didn't make it.
And you know what? Thank you for going.
Yeah.
Hey.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sean.
One more thing on the Confederate flag that you're talking about.
Yeah.
The only consideration with that is they are the most successful group of people to commit an act of treason against our country. And aside from what it represents with the slavery and the racism and this and that, the Confederates were treasonous to the cause of the United States, and that's why it shouldn't be flown anywhere in this country.
I agree. Thank you, Sean. Appreciate your call. The other thing is, it's the flag of the losers. I never understood that either. The Nazi symbol. I said, why are they these losers? I mean, here was Hitler, this twistoid supreme, right? And he says, we're going to have a 1,000-year Reich. 12 years.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't work real well. I mean, if you want, like, other symbols, maybe they ought to fly, like, you know, like repressive expansionist regimes. I mean, go like a Roman flag or something like that, you know,
okay.
Or the Chinese Empire or something, you know, but. I don't get it. Let's see here. Here is Anthony. Anthony, thanks for joining us. Go ahead. You're on the air.
All right, man. I've called on the Confederate flag, and I got one hanging from my around my house right now. It's not all about slavery. It's about power of the states, power of the people. The people that are still stuck with the slavery thing, that's long gone.
Well, wait. I don't get it. The reason that flag came into existence was these people rebelled against the United States because they thought, it didn't even happen, they thought that slavery was going to be abolished. And, you know, you can slice it and dice it, Anthony, but everyone sees it as a symbol of white supremacy.
I'm just trying to say it wasn't just about slavery, it was about power of the people, about state to state, the power of the state.
Nah, it was about power of the slaveocracy of these plantation owners that exploited white people and were able to make them stupid by thinking that they were somehow slightly superior to these chattel slaves. I mean, that period is so disgraceful in American history. The people that flew that flag are responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Americans on both sides because they did not want to live in a country, they wanted to create a country where it was okay to have slaves. And if you're attaching some other meaning to it, go ahead, but that's not the standard meaning of it.
How about put the power to the people today? Maybe you could find, and I'm trying just to be positive here, trying to find another symbol that you could, you know, put up instead. I mean, even something as simple as a peace sign, you know, I don't know if that would be too much of a tree hugger for you. But I have to say, if I drove by your house and saw that, I would give my, you know, I'd be with my husband, and I'd be one of these kind of, oh, no.
Yeah. And I would think, there's somebody that probably does not pick up their dog's poop.
Oh, come on, Peter. There you go again. Now, don't take this. Oh, geez.
All right.
And people say you have no sense of humor.
I'm serious. Yeah. Here's Al in Inkster. Al, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air. Hey, sorry to interrupt your meal. All right.
maybe he didn't know we were there.
No. He calls from time to time.
Okay.
Rogers from Oak Park. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Hi.
Peter?
Roger?
Yes.
It's me, Angeline.
Hi, Jolene.
Hi.
I've been listening. It's too bad people don't like to put aside their symbols. I wanted to say, Peter.
Yeah.
People fear truth.
Yeah. Well, Harry Truman, they used to say, give him hell, Harry. And he said, I don't give him hell. I just tell the truth, and they think it's hell. So you're right.
Yeah, they fear truth. And what you're doing is you're educating people. I wouldn't say educate enlightened because educating is more programming. But you're very enlightened. You know what you're talking about. I've been listening to you for quite some time.
Okay, good. What's up? What's on your mind?
Mostly the war. I've been paying attention. I'm a veteran.
Mm-hmm.
Not from Vietnam, just from about 25 years ago. It's going to stabilize after they get the democracy in there. Actually, I don't know why they're doing that, because there is no democracy. It's all caste system.
Well, I was going to say, it doesn't look like it's it's a religious state. And we've got Bush put these guys in there that are aligned to the Iranians. I don't get it.
You don't like to say it, but history does repeat itself. Some guy named Hegel said that. And it does. Man doesn't want to learn anything from history. He wants to keep on doing whatever he wants to.
Yeah.
So that's how that works.
Peter, that was it is a religious state of chaos.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's a...
And mass murder.
There's the same amount of disorganization over there as there is here.
It seems a little worse there. I mean, if
like I can get in my car and drive down Woodward and stop at the stoplights and get home safely.
Fortunately, there's not a lot of car bombers here. All right, Roger, thank you very much. I appreciate that call. Here's Nick in Detroit. Nick,
hey,
you're on the air. Hi. Hey, Nick.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
I just wanted to say about that caller that just called in and said that the Confederate flag represented power to the people.
Yeah.
What you really wanted to represent. You know, when our country originally rebelled from Great Britain in 1776, our idea was no taxation without representation. We wanted to give the power to our people of our country. And the flag that they flew was the snake, the flag with the snake that said, don't tread on me.
Right.
So why not fly that flag?
Well, it's because that's not a symbol of racism, if you get what I'm saying.
Right.
I mean, the Confederate flag is chosen very purposely by the people that fled. And it's not about freedom. It's about, they consider themselves rebels in the sense that they're rebelling against this idea of tolerance and diversity and what have you.
I truly believe that a lot of people, Peter, though, really do not understand that concept of the bigness of the racism.
I think you're too kind.
Well, I think some people just don't understand it.
We need kind people. Thank you, Nick. I took a course on the Civil War when I was at Michigan State.
Yeah.
And the professor, he said, office hours for Yankees, and he listed it. He said, rebels, appointment only.
What a character.
He was. He was indeed. Boy, this is so long. This is the most... You saw that. In a new joint U.S.-Iraqi patrol, the Americans go first. Do you have that?
Oh, yeah. That's, you know, it's real interesting because there's so much talk about what is the Iraqi army doing? Are we preparing them? You know, when are they going to be on their own? And this is an account of just a typical day
in
Baghdad.
We got to do the commercials.
Okay.
And then we'll be right back. Peter and Jelaine, 313-298-WRIF. And there is some open lines for you.
This is WRIF.com.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. At about 1 a.m., I shouldn't say about, at 1 a.m., I have a couple of guests on, so stay tuned for that. In fact, someone was wondering, how do they go about getting this discounted Citgo fuel oil to low-income families being offered by Joe Kennedy's Citizens Energy Corporation? I don't know. I can't tell you offhand. You're going to just have to listen. Or you can go to CitizensEnergyCorporation.com, I think it is, but or Google it. Joining me is Elaine Jordan, and we've been talking both about the anti-war march in Washington and also Ted Nugent wearing this Confederate flag as he played for the inauguration of the Republican governor of Texas.
Did you see the shirt?
No.
I saw a picture of it. It was actually a shirt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As opposed to a shirt.
T-shirt.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I got you.
I mean, he kind of dressed up a little.
Yeah. Let's see. Bike Man writes, I've listened to your show for about 11 to 12 years since the Detroit News, Detroit Free Press strike in 95-96, but after tonight's show, you let me down. There is much more to displaying the stars and bars, as it's called. Sure, there was slavery. Oh, yeah, of course. But just as the North, in that era, I don't get it. I mean, there was racism in the North, to be sure. But, yeah, there was more to it than slavery. There was also treason. I can't forget that, can we?
Them all the time.
No. Rod writes in the calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Hey, do you wait like I do for a snake tongue to slide out of Cheney's mouth, making a hissing noise?
Oh.
Maybe it's already happened. Should play back some of those videos of front face shots of Cheney, and don't let him get near your pets.
I like that. Yeah. Maureen Dowd in the New York Times says that delusional is far too mild a word to describe Dick Cheney, that it doesn't begin to capture the profound transcendental one flew over deafness of the man. I love Maureen Dowd.
She does. James Redigan from Kenosha, Wisconsin writes, so Ted the Boar has freedom of speech, can wear what he wants, according to Texas Governor Perry. And yet at the, I forgot about this. And yet at the 2006 State of the Union address, Cindy Sheehan was arrested for sitting in the gallery wearing a shirt that said 2,245 dead, how many more?
No
banner, no banner waving from the floor of the House, just a T-shirt in the gallery. As for my personal freedom of speech, I was escorted from a Bush rally for wearing a Sonic Youth Tour shirt that said "War is bogus." My son received the same escort for his shirt, the semi-famous shirt bearing a photo of Geronimo and three other Indians with rifles that says "Homeland Security fighting terrorism since 1492." Granted, we went to the rally with our wardrobe carefully chosen in order to test freedom of speech in Bush America, just as Mr. Nugent did.
Hey, you know, so I was right. That was a great point. And I remember that Cindy Sheehan T-shirt.
Yeah.
Ah, Cindy.
A poor guy, as Stephen writes. Please tell us about this program of Citgo gas grants. I could use some free go-go juice. I don't think it's, again, I think it's fuel oil for it all.
You know, if you have a computer, Google is a wonderful thing. You could go there and put Citgo grants or something in there that way. Or maybe, you know, eventually, Peter, maybe you'll have something on your website eventually.
Oh, I should. Actually, there is. Peter Werby, WERBE.com. Hi, Pete and Jolene. Until recently, I had a dark-skinned black girlfriend. One night while we were out, we saw a Confederate flag in the front of a car. I got angry about it. She was cool about it, saying, don't let it bother you, baby. They just have to live with being ignorant.
Well, she has a good attitude.
Yeah,
very
definitely.
Very good attitude.
I thought we had one more here. No, okay.
That we have full lines.
Oh, well,
full
let's lines, get back to them then and go through it again. Here's Al in Inkster. Al, you finish your meal? You ready to talk?
I was playing with my dog.
Oh, well, hey, you get a free pass for that.
Okay.
And now you've seen my dog.
I have?
Yeah, at the peace marches, remember?
Oh.
I had the little white one.
Oh, yeah, and you had signs on him?
On her, yeah.
On her, yeah. Do you pick up your dog's poop?
Yes, I do.
Okay. You must not be a conservative.
Except during the campaign when a couple of neighbors had Bush signs, and I was sorely tempted to leave it there, you know, not wanting to infringe on my dog's freedom of expression.
There you go. What's up?
I was calling to talk about the
the peace march and why there isn't, you know, why there isn't more activism around against the war.
Why is that? Why do you think?
No draft.
Well, that's commonly said, and I think there is a lot to it. But I think rebellion was a lot more in the air in the 1960s, for instance, as well as the draft. Sure, people had a personal interest in it. But like Bush and Cheney, most middle-class kids could stay out of it. They get scams like the two of them did all the while. Of course, they all the while were rooting on the troops to die and kill in Vietnam, just like they're doing now. But, yeah, if there was a draft, hey, absolutely, all heck would break loose.
Yeah, well, the rebellion needs to happen now before it gets popular to be rebellious. Like, a member of my family got me this really cool necklace for Christmas that says peace on it.
Awesome.
Well, you know, and she now bought one for herself, but she's never once been to any kind of rally or any kind of, you know what I'm saying, before it gets popular.
Well, yeah, let's have it not be a fashion symbol, but
thank
be real.
You.
Here's Bob from Royal Oak. Bob just got back from the D.C. rally as well. Bob, welcome to the broadcast.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Doing good.
Yeah, we just came in. Six of us drove in a van down there, left Friday night around 11, and drove all night, got there at dawn. And, but it truly was cool. And
yeah.
People don't understand, I think, the high from a crowd like that, the spirit that's there, is truly phenomenal. So
yeah, it is a high. It's an adrenaline rush.
It is.
Yeah.
I mean, I took my video camera, and at one point, I just kind of got to the side of the march and just let the crowd walk by it. And almost afraid to say it, but literally overcome and choked up and kind of tears just seeing all these people. I mean, 90-year-olds and people with strollers with three babies in them walking by, and tons of toddlers, more toddlers than I've ever seen at one of these things before this time. So
I should have gone.
It was pretty
cool.
You
see the 90-year-old ladies with their signs that they care so much.
Not just a few. I mean,
I know the raging grannies.
In this whole thing, it's thousands, tens of thousands. It's just such BS.
What do you think? How many do you think were there, Bob?
I would say 200,000, quarter million people. So, I know. I think Code Pink was probably saying 500,000 or so.
The Argonauts.
It is hard to say.
Yeah.
The other cool thing, though, you know, they didn't plan that route until that morning. They didn't give the organizers the exact route, and they weren't going to let them go all the way around the Capitol. It started and went down Constitution and came around and through the back, and then they were going to loop it right directly behind the Capitol and come back along the same route. Well, that lasted till the front of the parade got there about all of 5 or 10 minutes, and then a group of the anarchist dudes sort of said, nope, whose streets are streets, and just proceeded to march through, and it ended up going all the way around the whole deal. So it was kind of cool.
Those anarchists.
Yeah, well, followed by everybody else.
I'm glad.
It was led by anarchists and Jane Fonda.
I wonder if she was holding hands with them.
And the weather really added to it.
Yeah.
I was at one of those, the big one before the war started. I think this was bigger than that one, and that was the biggest thing I'd ever been to.
That's good.
And that was like 5 degrees that day. This was it was an incredible day.
Well, also, I have a sign that I've been wanting to take to one of those big marches that says, that I actually took from a sale. It says, everything must go.
That's good, Peter.
That is a good one.
I'll never bring it out in Detroit because there's, you know, like, as I think you know, in Royal Oak, we have about 150 people, there it would kind of look a little weird. But if you had like 150,000, 300,000, it would work.
It would.
Yeah.
Signs this time, there was just so many signs. But people that were doing the puppet stuff and everything, there was a chain gang dressed in prison stripes. And it was, they had on a Bush mask, Cheney mask, and a Condi mask. And they were literally chained to the ankles, had the ball swung over their shoulders, marching through this thing. It was great.
There's great theater.
Black and white stripes. So.
Great theater at that stuff.
Well, it is. It is just truly, you have to be there. And I think if more people experienced it, you know, coming back on the Metro after we're sitting next to a family, there's a young kid, 6, 7 years old, and I said, oh, yeah, he had on some buttons. Is it your first demonstration? He goes, oh, no, my second. All right. And if you have a good time, it's always great.
That's
so
great.
Inspiring. That's
it
another
is.
One.
It really is.
Well, thank you, Bob.
Okay.
Appreciate
care.
The report. coming in from D.C. for the big anti-war march as Bush's popularity plummets down to 30%. How would you like it if 70% of the people you knew didn't like you?
I would think that I was definitely doing something wrong.
There was just on, I saw either NBC or ABC on Saturday, it said that 67% of the people think that Bush is acting off his own personal emotions rather than facts about Iraq.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wasn't that amazing?
Let's see here. Here's Chris in Grosse Pointe. Chris, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to talk to you about your plan with Cheney's deals with Saudi Arabia on the oil production.
Right. Go ahead.
I was just wondering why, I mean, sorry for disagreeing with you here, but wouldn't it be a great thing that Cheney's working a deal with Saudi Arabia? We get more oil, prices drop, which is what we're all about, capitalism, supply, demand, lowest price, and we're denying Iran and Venezuela their income that they deserve. As far as I'm concerned, Iran's just using the aid money that they're given to build up their nuclear arms. Why should we not deny them income? I think we should deny them every cent that we're sending over there.
Well, wait a minute, Chris. The whole question is, what in the hell is the United States doing anything over in the Middle East at all? Why are we giving billions of dollars to Jordan and Israel and Egypt? Why are we fighting a war over there? Why are we sending battle groups over there? I mean, they keep talking about U.S. interest. Well, there's only one interest that Cheney et al. Has, and that's oil. So it's blood for oil. It's messing in other people's lives and countries and histories and strife and what have you, all so we can keep pumping this poisonous substance and keep us unnecessarily on this economy of oil that winds up to be environmental despoilization and wars. And rather than taking the hundreds of billions of dollars that these maniacs have already wasted, to say nothing of the lives and the destruction, and instead of creating an alternative fuel system that could easily be done with the amount of money that's being spent, they've got strategies for winning and countering Iran and all of that. I think our money could be spent much, much better. Thank you. Let's see. Dan's in Port Huron. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just think it's the fact that the stars and bars are for freedom of choice and religion and whatnot like that. According to the Constitution, they rose up and tried to overthrow a government that was trying to tell them what they could or could not do.
Well, they didn't tell them that at all. There was when what signaled the revolt of the southern states in this massive treasonous act was the election, the Democratic election of Abraham Lincoln. And freedom of choice, I mean, the freedom to enslave other people? That's not freedom.
No, it wasn't all about the slavery. Because they were free. It was choosing to, they were already choosing to free their slaves when they said that. Okay, they weren't trying to enslave them. They were trying to keep them to where they would work on their farms.
Well, if they, yeah, they were, you think that they were going to go from slavery to peonage, that in other words, that they were going to have people that were pretty much chained to the land as occurred after the Second World War, I'm sorry, after the Civil War, when the North and the Republicans turned their back on the freed slaves and allowed them to sink into this next hideous system that the white Southerners put upon the freed slaves of segregation. The history is hideous, and it stands for nothing else but that. Now, here's Nugent. He's wearing a Confederate flag shirt, and he starts making remarks about non-English speakers during his performance that is in a state that has millions of, or not, yeah, actually millions.
A large population.
Millions, yeah, of Spanish. I mean, the guy is a pendejo cabrón. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your... I mean, people try and explain away this. I mean, come on. Give me a break. It doesn't fly. Here's Jeff in Imlay City.
No pun intended. Yeah. Sorry.
Go ahead, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hey, good evening, Peter and Jolene. My thing is on the whole racism thing. To me, racism never existed. It's all ethnicism. Aren't we all the same race?
Sure, we're the human race.
When you look at it, you're the human race. I mean, to me, this gets ridiculous. We all look at some flags and all that, but a brother is a brother, a sister is a sister, a brother to sister, sister to brother. To me, it just gets crazy. Uncle Ted went a little crazy down there in Texas wearing that. But, you know, I served 20 years in the Navy, and, you know, I know you guys support our folks over there. But for what they're getting, what kills me is, you know, the Israelis have this RPG deterrent machine that we won't even use because we got to go through Grumman or, you know, one of our other companies. It's got a 98% effectiveness rate, but that's not good enough for our government to use to help our troops that are over there right
now. I don't get most of what they're doing, that's for sure. I'm going to have to cut this a little short, Jeff, because we're almost out of time, and I've got a number of other people I want to go get on the line. So thank you for your comments. Yeah, who was it? I just heard a singer. Oh, man, I can't think of it. But he was talking about, you know, aliens. He's the only aliens are from outer space, right?
There you go.
Here's Terrence in Detroit. Terrence, hi. Tell me quick.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well. Got about a minute for you, though.
Okay, that's good. I want to know why it is that they want to make these weapons of mass destruction and destroy everything that's here.
These people are crazy. That's why, Terrence.
They are crazy, and they want to suck the earth dry or all the precious minerals for what?
Well, to make
convenience.
Them, make themselves richer.
And money.
You know, I was just hearing, I was just listening to a radio program, Terrence, about, do you ever see the film Dr. Strangelove?
Yes, I have.
Okay, then it's nothing new to you. But I haven't seen it in so many years. I'm going to go back and check it out. And that's the kind of mentality that still rules in Washington. All right, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. Here's Jesse in Detroit. Jesse, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, how's it going?
Going good.
I had a few things to say about the situation over in Iraq. First of all, I feel that we don't have any business being over there with all the troops and money we're spending.
Mm-hmm.
And just in general about the country, we use more resources and we're in more debt than any other country, you know, around. And just, you know, given the course of history, every country that's a superpower, every class of people usually comes to end. There's a rise and fall of everything. And right now, the situation given in the world, I think everything's coming to a head right now.
I'm afraid you could very well be correct that the whole idea of the rise and fall of great empires, and if you extend too far, you put too much on the board, and the loss can be catastrophic. Thank you for being our last caller. I appreciate it. Jelaine, hello.
Jelaine? Yes.
No, I was not saying your name correctly. I was the legions of people that... don't say your name correctly.
I guess that's how used to it.
Yes.
I am.
It's Juline. Jelaine Jordan. You go to jelainejordan.com. You can go to peterwerby.com. Werbe. Stay tuned for the interviews.
Yes.
And we'll talk next week.
Sounds great, Peter.
This is WRIM.com.
Very cool, San Francisco. Thank you.
gray skies.
The hell with this.
Don't say it!
Maui Time 2007, presented by Budweiser. Just keep your radio locked on 101 WRIM. When you hear Big Daddy shout those three magic words, you could win the ultimate getaway.
Ready for some fun in the sun?
A week-long trip for two to the sun and surf of Kaanapali Beach in Maui with your host with the most, a big kahuna, Arthur Pithallow. Maui Time 2007. Listen and win. Exclusively from Budweiser. This is beer and your official Maui Time station, 101. WRIM. Everything that rocks.
Baby!
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. As you know from listening to this broadcast, I and my guests frequently point out the problems that we have in this country and in the world, for that matter. And I think it's important to look at problems because then you can begin to fix them. The fixes aren't really available. And oftentimes, I have to say, I have more criticisms than solutions. I don't apologize for that. In fact, I think it's unfortunate. But I'd like to bring to our microphone someone who is involved in problem solving at the point where it really matters a lot, and that is the individual health, welfare, creature comforts of a lot of our citizens. Joining me is Pete Smith. He is part of the Citizens Energy Corporation. He's the chief operating officer, and the Citizens Energy Corporation was founded by Joseph P. Kennedy II in 1979, and Joseph Kennedy served as chairman and president of the company since 1998. He served 12 years in the House of Representatives from the 8th District in Massachusetts. Joining me from Boston is Pete Smith. Thanks for being with me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks for having me, Pete. It's a pleasure to be on.
Well, I know of your group and the work it's done, but it actually turned out to be pretty one-dimensional. I went to your website, citizensenergy.com, and saw that there's quite a bit to it. But maybe you could give us an overview to begin with what the Citizens Energy Corporation does.
Sure. Citizens Energy Corporation is a Boston-based nonprofit company. It was founded and is still run, as you mentioned, by Joe Kennedy. And very simply, Joe started the company back in 1979 with a simple purpose. He wanted to have a nonprofit company that participated in energy markets, and at the time, the energy market Joe chose was crude oil trading and crude oil refining. And he wanted to use the profits from business activities in those businesses to fund charitable programs, namely charitable programs to help low-income individuals and senior citizens help offset the rising costs of energy prices. So that was the founding principle in 1979, and it still continues to this day. We don't necessarily do any crude oil trading or crude oil refining anymore, but engage in a number of business activities which generate profit, and we use those profits to pay for our charitable programs. And we've over the years been in natural gas, electricity trading, pharmaceutical drugs, and most recently, Pete, our business activities were a developer of renewable energy in North America, mostly with wind farms, and we also are a developer of high voltage transmission lines. We're working on a project out in California to bring renewable energy from where it's generated out in the desert to where it's needed in Southern California where people live. So those are kind of the main thrusts of our business focus these days, in addition to the charitable activities that I'm sure we'll talk about later.
Yeah, I say this, Pete Smith, not as a joke either, but I wish you would have given the State of the Union message, because when I think of so little that was touched upon in that speech by George W. Bush, yet just in a summary of how many aspects of our environment and what we need to keep our houses warm and lit that you touched on. Were you very happy with what you heard in the president's State of the Union speech in terms of your concerns?
Well, I think, you know, as a nonprofit, we have to be pretty careful about not weighing too heavily into the political arena, but I think as just a citizen of the United States, it's shocking and disappointing how little time and attention and real action is given towards, you know, renewable energy and climate change. I would submit perhaps if my boss was given an address about the State of the Union and specifically our energy crisis, there would be a lot more specific things that he could speak to and recommend that would help get this country in the right direction on our energy policy. So I have to agree with you, but I have to do that with a bit of caution.
I hear you. Well, you use the phrase energy crisis. Is it a crisis?
Well, Peter, you know, it's a crisis. Let me just try to bring it back to what Citizens Energy does, which is, you know, we try to, you know, focus our activities on things that are aimed at helping low-income households, people who are having a hard time keeping up with the rising energy costs. We try to help them make ends meet. You know, our kind of motto is make sure nobody is left out in the cold. Being here in Boston in the wintertime, like Detroit, it's cold. If we talked about some of the work we're doing in Southern California and El Centro in the desert, it's not so much a staying warm issue, it's a staying cool issue, and it's helping to pay for the electric bills to keep the air conditioners running so you don't die from 120-degree heat in the peak of the summertime. So, you know, we focus our work on trying to, you know, participate in the energy business in a responsible way, you know, renewable energy and transmission lines to unleash shut-in renewable energy. And on the charitable side, really trying to help people cope with rising energy prices and do that not just with discounted heating oil, for instance, but also with, you know, conservation, weatherization programs and the like.
I know that the Citizens Energy Corporation is best known for its energy assistance, fuel assistance, and I think that people don't realize how many people in the Northeast, where you're centered, Pete Smith, actually depend on fuel oil for heating. I remember I ran into a woman on my block that said she heated with oil. I said, really? Because there's not very many people left here, but it's not the case in the Northeast, is it?
Oh, that's right, Pete. That's a good point. Although our program this year does operate in Michigan, where there are a large number of low-income families who receive federal fuel assistance, the truth is less than 4% of the people in Michigan actually use heating oil to heat their home. If you contrast that here in the Northeast, for instance, a state like Massachusetts, which may have a total of about 125,000 people who receive federal fuel assistance, but only about a third of them heat their home with heating oil. So one third of the population here in Massachusetts. The outer extreme would be a state like Maine, where up to three quarters of the families in Maine use heating oil to heat their home. And very simply, heating oil is just simply diesel fuel. It's the same thing. One is used in the car and pays higher prices for transportation taxes. The other goes into your home and is the fuel that your furnace burns to heat the water or the air in your house.
Mm-hmm. And I assume that home fuel oil, heating oil, has the same variations in price that gasoline does. It goes up and down with the cost per barrel of oil.
It very much tracks along the price of a crude oil, price of a barrel of crude oil. One of the things in the energy markets, anybody who's in it knows, and even people who pay for gas realize, when crude oil prices go up, the price of heating oil and gasoline quickly follows in lockstep. As prices of crude oil comes down, you don't see the prices of the finished product, crude, gasoline, and heating oil necessarily falling at the same pace. There's a delay. It takes a little longer, so you kind of get the worst of it on both ends, but that's just the way the energy markets tend to work for the consumer.
Now, unfortunately, I first came upon the work, the good work of the Citizens Energy Corporation through the controversy that the fuel oil was coming from Venezuela, and there were a number of people that thought this inappropriate source, given the way that the president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, had spoken not so much about America, but about George W. Bush. And tell me about the origins of your fuel oil, where, you know, and that whole process, because I know it's not just from Venezuela. You get it from other countries as well, right?
Yeah, in the past we have. The current that's a good question, Pete, and it's a lot of people, I think, are confused. It's interesting just to take a second and understand how we started working with Citgo, which is the company we're working with now to provide our discounted heating program in 16 states. Citizens Energy, as I mentioned, we've run a number of charitable programs over the years. Something we've done in Massachusetts, our home state, is run a discounted heating oil program for low-income families for well over 20 years. Families in Massachusetts who met certain income guidelines could get a delivery of significantly discounted heating oil, and we would pay for that, and we would pay for that out of our own pocket, out of the profits I talked about. About 2 years ago, as prices of heating oil were increasing dramatically, Joe Kennedy, my boss, wrote to a number of the major oil companies and a number of the major oil countries that export oil to the United States. And this was at a time when they were recording, you know, record profits, absolute astounding numbers of, you know, up to $10 billion of profit a quarter for some of these companies like ExxonMobil. So Joe wrote to them in his very influential way to say, how about sharing some of those profits and helping us extend the reach of our discounted heating oil program to low-income families across the United States that are struggling with their heating bills. And interestingly, most of them just simply never returned the call or returned the letter. The few that did said that's not the kind of charitable program that they want to support, and they divert their charity in other ways. And only one company, and one company only, responded positively to Joe's requests, and that was Citgo, based in Houston. Now, Citgo happens to be owned by the country of Venezuela, or their national oil company, PDVSA, and they were delighted to work with us and said, hey, that they were trying to find a program just like the one we ran in Massachusetts. So we started a program last year, Pete, in six states, and we expanded it this year to 16, and we're able to fund that significant increase beyond just Massachusetts from the generosity of Citgo and them making available to us discounted heating oil that we can work with dealers to deliver to low-income households.
Now, the political spur in this, of course, is the conflict, at least the verbal conflict that Hugo Chavez has with George W. Bush, and this has kind of come back to kind of bite you a bit, hasn't it?
It has. You know, it's some maybe disappointing when you feel you're doing good work and people still feel that they should criticize it. People have criticized this program because they feel it's coming from a source, Venezuela, that is an enemy of the United States. And, you know, I don't think the country of Venezuela is an enemy of the United States. For instance, every major oil company in this country right now, U.S. oil companies owned by U.S. shareholders, does business in Venezuela. And they do business right now and earn millions and millions of dollars of profit from their work in Venezuela. Lots of other U.S. companies, not in the oil business, in the automotive business, similarly do business in Venezuela and make lots of money.
Halliburton is one that's doing a lot of business, increasing as like 4,000 employees in Venezuela.
A very large number. So, yeah. You know, that doesn't sound like a country that is an enemy of this country. And similarly, you know, here in the Northeast, nearly 40% of all the heating oil that ends up in people's households here in the Northeast comes from Venezuela. That's where it's refined. That's where the crude oil originates from. Some of it is sold through Citgo. Some of it is sold through the other heating oil wholesalers up here. But they supply a very large amount of heating oil that's used here in the Northeast for people to stay warm. And most of that, Pete, is, you know, sold and purchased at full price.
Mm-hmm.
And taking umbrage to basically one half of 1% of all the crude oil that Venezuela imports to the United States, that's what our program represents, one half of 1% of their total crude oil imported to the U.S. Taking umbrage with that small amount being offered at a 40% discount to families who are low income and having a hard time, I just don't understand the logic in that, regardless of what the president of Venezuela, his differences that he may or may not have with the president of our country.
Pete Smith is my guest. He is the chief operating officer of the Citizens Energy Corporation. You're listening to the Peter Werby Show. Well, if I was reminded, I think in Chicago was about to increase its transit fares, and CITGO offered to give them discounted fuel if they would leave the prices as they were. And Chicago refused it and raised the prices, which, of course, then essentially for that gesture, the poor wound up carrying more financial weight. You're right. I don't get that.
And Pete, unfortunately, we've experienced some of that similar reaction in the various states we've extended our program to. As I mentioned, there's 16 states. Michigan is one of them, Indiana, Wisconsin, and then mostly the kind of northeast down to kind of Maryland and Virginia, places that have that are cold and use some or a lot of heating oil. However, you know, some of those 16 states that I mentioned, we've asked to work with some of the state governments to help us identify the low-income households so we can let them know about the program and let them know that if they'd like to take advantage of it, all they need to do is give us a call and fill out an application, which is very simply 1-877-JOE, J-O-E, 4, the number 4, OIL. Most of the states are very happy to help extend a benefit to people that they know could use it. Unfortunately, some states, for whatever reason, feel that any kind of affiliation with this program is somehow an endorsement of President Chavez and his policies, which I think couldn't be further from the truth, and have chosen not to participate and cooperate with us, which simply means it's just a little bit more difficult for us to reach the low-income families that live in that state that should have a chance to take advantage of our program.
Pete Smith, put a human face on this. Like, who, I know in one of Joe Kennedy's letters where he was talking about this assistance program, the origin of the oil, the energy, he made reference to one person. Flesh this out a little. What are we looking at in both who and what kind of savings are we giving to the poor through your program?
Sure. Good question, Pete. The basic program elements are we provide low-income families, and I'll help you to understand what I mean by that, with a one-time delivery of 200 gallons of heating oil, and that those 200 gallons would come at a 40% discount to the regular retail price. So very simply, just to do some math, and 200 gallons is most residential heating oil tanks are somewhere in the 225 to 250 gallon range, and you don't like to get those things down to dry. So 200 gallons is about a fill up, and in the middle of winter time, depending on the temperatures, a fill up will last you anywhere between 2 and 4 weeks, depending on how cold it is and what you set your heat to. So a family that normally would get a 200-gallon delivery and pay a retail price of $2.50 a gallon for that would expect to have a $500 heating oil bill for, let's say, a three-week period. Under our program, the heating oil dealer that serves that family right now will make the delivery of 200 gallons, and instead of collecting $500 from the customer, will collect $300, 60% of the price. And the difference, the $200, 40% of that delivery, they will send a bill to me at Citizens Energy, and I will pay that bill and reimburse the dealer the full amount. So the dealer gets paid the full amount. The customer still got a 200-gallon delivery, the financial means for that discount for the low-income family ultimately started with CITGO and came through us.
You sort of lost me there. I mean, I thought CITGO was providing this at discounted prices.
CITGO makes available to citizens large amounts of discounted heating oil at wholesale prices.
Right.
I then work on the wholesale heating oil markets to turn that discount into the assistance that I ultimately pay to the dealer when the dealer makes a delivery. Okay. You know, the retail heating oil distribution market would be very inefficient if I actually had a gallon of heating oil that I got from CITGO and I needed to deliver to a family in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Instead, what I do is I contact the dealer in Grand Rapids, Michigan and say, when you make that delivery, I don't care where you got your heating oil, when you make that delivery, send me a bill for 40% of it and I'll make up the difference.
Huh.
So you take the physical wet barrels that get-go is made available to citizens, and I turn that into essentially a paper benefit and the financial benefit, which is really, at the end of the day, all the low-income family is looking for.
What are we talking about when we say low-income, just because there's people listening?
What our program aims to do is anybody who earns less than 60% of the state median income is eligible for our program. Now, just to kind of put a little bit of granularity around that, right now in the United States, the federal government puts about $2 billion, which they cut by a third this year, used to be $3 billion, $2 billion into a program called LIHEAP, Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program. And that money gets allocated to each state, and each state is responsible for distributing it to low-income families. Each state is allowed to set their own income guidelines for that, and they can be as generous as 60% of the state median income, or they can be more restrictive and say, if that was $40,000 for a family, the state might say, we only want to give the benefit to people who earn $30,000. And then, therefore, eligible families would get more dollars versus spreading out the same number of dollars over more families. Our program aims to be a little bit more generous to the maximum amount allowed by the government in terms of a family. And I apologize, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but just generally speaking, 60% of state median income for a family of four in a state like Michigan would equate to something in the low 40,000s.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly, it's not abject poverty, but it's somebody who would be having a difficult time making ends meet with a potentially $500 heating oil bill every 2 to 3 weeks in the middle of the wintertime.
Well, and we're just starting to get some cold weather here, too. And I know, the person I was speaking about that said one of the few people in our area that heats with oil, I'm going to get this right to him. You call 1-800-JOE, J-O-E, 4, the numeral, O-I-L, Joe for oil. Or you can go to citizensenergy.com. Pete Smith, the chief operating officer.
Pete, I got to correct you. I'm sorry on one thing. It's 1-877.
Oh, okay.
Joe for oil. We couldn't get the 800 number, so we took 877, but you were 99% right.
Yeah, well, that's good. I can take that somewhere. If all of a sudden you said, I'm not going to take Citgo oil anymore, what would be the consequences? How many people would suffer, or how many people would it affect? Let's give a neutral word there.
Pete, this winter with the Citgo program that we're running, we're going to be able to make a delivery of this discounted heating oil that I mentioned to about 400,000 families across these 16 states. Before Citgo came along, when it was just Citizens Energy and we ran our own program in Massachusetts, we served about 15,000 families a year here in Massachusetts. That was really all the resources that we had internally to support a program like that. So we're able to extend that to a lot more people in a lot more states because of Citgo's program. If this program went away, we couldn't serve those 400,000 families. In a perfect world, we've asked other, as I mentioned, other oil companies and countries to help support us because, nothing would make us happier to be able to extend the program from 400,000 families to a million families. But, right now we're limited to the willingness of Citgo to extend the program.
Now, this is so important, the work that you're doing. On the other hand, in the wealthiest country in the world, doesn't it suggest that something's wrong, that a private group of individuals have to take on this project that should almost be coming as a matter of course from the general funds?
Well, you bring up a good point. There's certainly a lot of discussion in D.C. about this. The level of funding that this LIHEAP program, which is basically government fuel assistance to help people stay warm, it was at $3 billion last year and it's been cut by a third. It's $2 billion this year. How a decision like that can get made in the face of the prices that we've all seen in the past 3-4 years, the prices of these commodities, whether you heat with natural gas or heating oil or even electricity, have doubled. So to cut a program like that by a third doesn't make a lot of sense. Nonetheless, given that's the situation, we're fortunate that companies like Citgo have the philanthropic philosophy to contribute some of their profits to help people stay warm. And we very much appreciate what CITGO does and think it's, you know, it's laudable. And as Secretary Bodman, Secretary of Energy, has said himself, he applauds what CITGO does and wishes more companies would do it. Nonetheless, you know, keep in mind, selling oil to Citizens Energy at a 40% discount from today's prices is nothing different than selling the oil 2 years ago at full retail prices. That's how much prices have gone up in 2 years. So, and they're selling me 0.5% of the total amount of product they sell in this country.
Wow.
So it's very noble what they do, and I think it's just smart and good business and good corporate citizenship, and that's what we're seeing.
Yeah, I know that when I go to the pump, I always go to a CITGO station because I know that at least these profits aren't going back to pay the ExxonMobil ex-CEO's $400 million retirement fund or the hundreds of millions of dollars their executives make in profits. And in fact, in some ways, it's odd to say. I mean, I guess I'd rather... back in the day when it was 89 cents a gallon, but paying near to $3 at the a year ago or so, I thought, well, this is not going to some fat cat's pocket, and if part of it is going to the Citizens Energy Corporation to help poor, I have no problem with it whatsoever.
Well, I'm sure somewhere deep in the corporate offices of CITGO in Houston, there was a marketing or a business person who that thought was not lost on. Nonetheless, you know, the fact is CITGO has stepped up to the plate. They are doing it, and they are the one company that has put their money where their mouth is on this program and are directly helping hundreds of thousands of low-income families. And as Joe has done when he makes a delivery to a household and goes into the house and sees the conditions, the people who receive this benefit, Pete, they sure don't look at it politically. They look at it as, you know, much appreciated help to keep warm during a cold winter month.
Absolutely. Pete Smith, thanks for being with us. Peter F. Smith is the Chief Operating Officer of the Citizens Energy Corporation. You can go to citizensenergy.com. If you want to apply for the program, you can do it online as well, right?
Yes.
Yeah, or you can dial directly to 877-JOE-4, the number, OIL. JOE-4-OIL, 877. Pete Smith, thanks for being with me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Pete.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Thank you.
with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Well, we are recording on Wednesday, the day after George W. Bush's State of the Union speech, something he's required by the Constitution to provide each year to tell the State of the Union. Joining me to discuss this, and remember, we're hearing this on Sunday, and it's already been pretty dissected. One of the things that maybe we can do is kind of dissect some of the dissections. Joining me is William Hartung. He's a senior research fellow at the World Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. Bill Hartung's been a guest many times on the Peter Werby Show. Bill, welcome back to the broadcast.
Yes, thanks for having me back.
Well, the first line of the New York Times, Dateline Washington today, says President Bush tried to resuscitate his ailing presidency Tuesday night. How would you rate that attempt?
Well, I think the patient is still on life support.
Okay. Where were the weakest points in your estimation?
Well, I think he throughout, there was kind of a fundamental weakness just in terms of the fact that when he got done, the networks were saying it was a somber address. But I thought the foreign policy sections were particularly weak because he didn't have anything new to say. He was kind of using rhetoric that he could have used 3 or 4 years ago. And aside from, Republicans who kind of were forced to clap, I guess, he got a pretty, unsympathetic or at least indifferent response, which is not normal in the State of the Union. Normally everybody feels like, well, you got to clap for the president even when you disagree with him.
Prior to this last election in November, when the Democrats came to power in Congress, it was felt by many observers and many particularly critics of the Bush administration that they were on a particularly well-defined trajectory towards the right and domestically in terms of eliminating social programs, an imperial presidency that extended American military power abroad. Has that been altered? In fact, well, let me ask you first, do you think that that was accurate, with what the critics said? I think you've been one of them. And has the trajectory been deflected?
Well, I think it is accurate. The sort of summary you gave of where the Bush folks were heading, I think the trajectory in terms of reality has been altered. In terms of Bush's thinking, I don't think it's been altered, unfortunately. He's still going to trot out some sort of Social Security reform, which may or may not bring back his notion of personal accounts. His Iraq policy is still couched in terms of victory, in terms of it being the central front in the war on terror. So we haven't seen much change from him. His escalation policy was drafted by Frederick Kagan, who's at the American Enterprise Institute, one of the prominent neocons who got us into this mess in the first place. But I think what's changing is his ability to carry out that agenda.
In other words, with a Democratic Congress. Now, sometimes I think, in fact, I usually think too much is made of presidents and politicians' personalities, that what we really have to look at are their policies. And I know that's one of the things you study, Bill Hartung, at the World Policy Institute. But is there a personality factor? I mean, people have talked about Bush just getting bored with this, that he's, like so many other things in his life, he's just ready to move on, yet he's sitting there in the White House for another couple of years.
I think that is a factor. I mean, when he was running and when he was first elected, John Alter from Newsweek gave a talk here at the Institute, and he called him Incurious George. I mean, basically that Bush might not be as dumb as people thought, but that he just didn't have a great deal of interest in what was going on in the world. And I think, when he's not in a position to kind of pound on the podium and get what he wants, I think his attention does wander. And it's kind of, I think he's kind of an unenlightened builder of empire. He really, even from his own perspective of what his administration seems to want,
his policies are counterproductive at this point.
Now, he's rejected pretty much other paths towards peace or a resolution of the situation in Iraq, including his father's counsel in many ways, and certainly there's been so many other alternatives, contrary to what the Republicans say. There's any number of other alternatives on the block here. But you mentioned about one of the prominent neoconservatives still advising him on war policy, yet a lot of the neocons and some of the most prominent ones, particularly the ones that got us into the war in the first place, they're sort of scattered to the winds.
Well, yes. I think they're trying to save what's left of their reputations, so they don't want to be associated with some of their statements about the war being a cakewalk, about being greeted with flowers and candy, about how there were almost assuredly weapons of mass destruction, about tight links with Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, all those things that were proven false, you know, over and over again. And so there's a number of different approaches. One is to say, well, they should have installed Jalabi and they would have had democracy earlier. One is to say, well, it wasn't carried out right. He didn't send enough troops. He didn't, really work for the appropriate kind of political solution on the ground. So a lot of them haven't completely backed off, but they've become significant Bush critics. It's sort of like, well, you know, we told you to do this, but we didn't know you were going to do it this way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was actually going to save the war till the end, but I sort of stumbled us into it in sort of the same way that the country got into it. The panel, the Democratic-controlled Senate Foreign Relations Committee, has just voted 12-9 along party lines, pretty much, to repudiate Bush's plans for escalation. Is this going to have any impact?
I think it will. I mean, it doesn't change anything that Bush is able to do. They're not going after funding, for example. But it's interesting in the echo chamber of the media, the sort of mainstream media, how they are treating these non-binding resolutions as major rejections of Bush and the greatest level of opposition to a president from Congress since Vietnam. And, Tim Russert said on NBC that if Bush doesn't respond to some of these things, some of his own Republicans who are up for re-election are going to tell him it's time to get out of there. So I don't think the reality of it is all that great, since they haven't gone after the money. But I think the perception of it may have some benefits, just in the sense that people are going to start feeling like, Bush is kind of, a loser, I guess would be the simplest way of putting it.
We're talking with Bill Hartung from the World Policy Institute about the State of the Union speech, and I just grabbed this news release off the wire. I don't know what they call it now, but it says Senate panel votes against Bush on Iraq, and it was 12-9, and I'm looking through there. I see so many Republican names in here. Did you get a chance to see which Republicans voted for it?
Well, I was just looking at it on the Washington Post, and I didn't notice that part, of who.
Yeah, maybe, I don't see, because it talks about Norm Coleman of Minnesota is up for re-election, maybe against Al Franken.
That would be fun.
That'll be Gordon Smith, George Voinovich, all who were talking about it, but.
Well, it looks like Chuck Hagel and Olympia Snow co-sponsored, so those are two, but there may well have been a third, and I don't know who that may have been. I know there was some Republicans who didn't like using words like escalation, which was kind of interesting, but still wanted to distance themselves from the president. And I think they tried to accommodate them by taking that word out of there. But
this should pass, of course. We have one Democrat still hospitalized. Joe Lieberman will probably vote against it, and a couple Republicans for it. So it should probably pass when it comes to the entire Senate.
I think so. There was some talk by Lindsey Graham of, trying to do a filibuster, which is kind of an extreme measure for a non-binding resolution, and I think might just hurt Bush's cause further.
Yeah, and also Bush was talking about voting judges up and down, right, without any of this kind of stuff. Although a filibuster is in the tradition of the Senate, to be sure.
Yeah. And I think it's been used for good or ill, but I think it's hard to just throw it out the window over any specific
Now, I had a call, a friend of mine. I actually have an awful bet, at least on his part. He is certain, that the United States, that George W. Bush is going to order a major military strike against Iran by summertime. I'm betting that he won't. Would you like to get in on the bet, Bill Harton?
I think that he won't. I mean, the only reason that he might is because he's George W. Bush. And so there's not, you know, rationality doesn't always reign. But I think the professional military is against it, arguing that it'd be hard to find targets of the Iran military nuclear program that would necessarily, you know, knock it out of the water for a significant amount of time, because how Iran might respond in terms of arming militias and so forth in Iraq and in other areas where they have influence. And needless to say, the U.S. reputation in the Arab world and the amongst key allies in Europe and so forth would probably be in negative numbers if that were possible after such an action. So I think there's a lot of things working against it, but there are people in the administration who are for it. So I think it is going to be an internal debate, and I think the more we could get people to speak out against that idea, and particularly some members of Congress who you haven't heard as much about, not escalating against Iran as you have about the Iraq issue. I think it'd be helpful if a few key members started talking about that.
Well, sort of a conspiratorial theory behind it is that the Bush cabal, in their way of looking at things, reigns high when there's chaos. And if there were actually strikes back against the United States, this would serve the purpose of the Bush administration. It might even take his record low numbers out of the basement where they are. And also, of course, that this any war, act of war, brings more billions of our tax dollars, which we should get to in about a second, to his base, the military contractors, the Halliburtons and the others. Any stock in that?
Well, I think that could be part of the thinking for those that are advocating it, but I think, first of all, I think even his base is getting a little tired of the fear-mongering. And obviously not the contractors, but there's even been some evangelicals who said, you know, Bush has screwed up the war in Iraq, we don't like the way he handled it, we don't trust him to get the nation involved in another conflict. So I think it would have diminishing returns compared to what he was able to get away with after September 11th.
All right, we're talking about the State of the Union speech, and traditionally, and I don't know the origins of this, but towards the end, oftentimes the president will say this at the beginning, the State of the Union is strong. Bush said this towards the end. Yeah, in fact, do you know, is that just tradition to say that phrase? I'm sure it's not in any foundation document.
I don't know how long that's been the case. I mean, it's sort of interesting because it sort of indicates from the beginning that you got to put, you know, pretty much a positive spin on everything you say. I had written a sample State of the Union of what a new president might say in 2009, and I was trying to give it kind of an optimistic approach of what positive things the country has accomplished and things that we could tackle in the future. And a lot of my progressive friends said, well, what about the millions of people that have died in U.S. interventions? What about the money we're spending on the military and highways and all these negative, potentially negative, sources? I probably shouldn't say that in Detroit. In any case, there's kind of a, if you want to tell the truth is not always positive, and I think there's not much room in it accepted format to really speak the truth in any serious sense.
Well, let's go to one thing that concerns listeners here and millions of people around the country, and that is the lack of or extraordinarily expensive health care. And Bush had a two-pronged approach to it, that there would actually be tax deduction for poorer families to help them buy it. But then, and reading here from Associated Press, that 30 million Americans could face a tax hike under President George W. Bush's plan to expand health coverage. And Kate Baker of a member of the White House Council of Economic Advisors said there's always going to be some winners and some losers, which is an interesting observation. But tell us about this Bush health plan and how it would affect someone without health care right now, and how would it affect somebody like me, for instance, who has really excellent health care through my employer.
Well, I congratulate you on that.
It's rare.
Somebody like you would obviously pay this tax. Somebody who is too poor or for other reasons doesn't have health insurance would get a tax credit, a tax break that they're supposed to then spend on buying private health insurance. So part of the problem with that is it doesn't do anything to cap the high cost of health insurance, the bureaucracy involved, and so forth. And the example he gave was, somebody making $60,000 could save $4,500, which they could then put to buying health insurance. When my wife was laid off in the New York State context, and we used there's a little extension program you can do through the state to keep your insurance. It was costing us $1,800 a month.
Whoa.
So that may be out of line with what might happen in the rest of the country, but it's indicative, I think, that's not a lot of money. And of course, if you're below the poverty line, where's the money going to come from? I mean, a tax break doesn't help you. You're probably not paying taxes. Tax credit, maybe of some value, but it's going to come partly at the expense of they want to take some of the Medicaid money away from supporting public hospitals and give it to individuals. So no matter where you look, it's kind of robbing Peter to pay Paul, and it doesn't go into all the other areas of the budget where there's billions and billions of dollars being wasted where you might shift money into health care.
Well, when I said about, sometimes, I mean, it almost sounds like saying, when I say I have a good health plan, it's almost like saying, hey, I have a Cadillac these days. It shouldn't be. Everyone should have a health program like I have, and as far as I'm concerned, should be universal health care, single payer through the government like every other industrialized nation. But that's not, there's not any move forward towards that at all, right? This is just, if it even happened, would be a boon for the insurance companies.
Yes, because it doesn't really put any limits on them, and it throws a little more money out there for them to get from folks for policies that I don't know that he's setting any standards as to what these policies have to cover. So even for folks who might be enable to buy them, there might be huge kind of gaping holes mm-hmm. in those policies.
And Baker described Bush's proposed tax changes as, quote, revenue neutral, meaning they would neither increase nor decrease the overall income taxes paid to Washington. And I'll tell you, given that I am in a fortunate and privileged position in this society because of a lot of reasons, if it meant paying more taxes in order to help people that don't have any, I would say okay, because there should be some equity in the society that's not present. However, we are going to wind up spending $2.2 trillion on the war in Iraq that could have been easily used to pay for an entire medical program for all of us, right?
Yes, and it's, now it's, they're bleeding money at about $8 billion a month or more, and that doesn't count the cost in terms of what it's doing to our economy, what it's doing to oil prices, what it's doing in terms of the, vets who've been traumatized and injured and so forth, and how much it'll cost to take care of them. So it's just this expense that keeps snowballing. And of course, this was the administration that got rid of their economic advisor, Lawrence Lindsay, after he claimed that it might cost $200 billion. So if you look at the full economic effect, we're pushing towards 10 times that.
Sure. Now, if there's a base left for Bush, it's within the middle class, so he's not going to score any points by telling the middle class, which already feels pretty strapped economically, that he's going to raise their taxes on their medical plans. This doesn't seem like it will go anywhere.
No, I don't think it will. I think it might just be they wanted something to put out there so you didn't have to start the speech with Iraq. But it doesn't seem like a very serious plan.
How about some of the other aspects of the State of the Union speech? There was, you can't, I was listening to it on the radio, and so I couldn't see who was clapping, but at one point they were talking about oil independence again, increasing fuel standards, making ethanol, for instance, being a large part of our fuel economy and all of that. Is that going anywhere?
Well, unless there's some compromise. I mean, you know, fuel standards, he didn't say how much he might increase them. He didn't say how he would, you know, change his tack in terms of auto industry and others who have, you know, historically not wanted that. You know, I think it could actually help our industry if they had better standards, because a lot of consumers are looking for that now. But so I think, you know, if he did that, and however, you know, modest a level, that would be a shift of course from the sort of, you know, just say no approach that they've had to increasing fuel efficiency of automobiles. But then a lot of his proposals involved research on technologies that might or not come in online for some years. Nothing about capping carbon emissions from electricity plants, which covers about 40% of the greenhouse gases that are emitted. You know, nothing about helping create more efficient buildings and, you know, green design techniques and things that could be applied in the near term. So it's got a little bit of a sense of, you know, I think this is great, and that's why I'm going to kick it down the road as far as I can, so that I'm not responsible for actually implementing anything.
Mm-hmm. I think we spoke a year ago or so about Bush's proposal, and you just indicated it at the beginning of our conversation, Bill Hartung, about Social Security. I just heard the other day, again, some commentator said, and if Medicare and Social Security isn't addressed, it's going to be bankrupt. There was just passing reference to that, if I remember right.
Yes. It was sort of a modest version of the kind of rhetoric he was using when he tried to pass his original Social Security plan. And I think if he couldn't do it then, when he had much greater influence, much stronger political standing, I don't see how he's going to be able to do it now. I mean, I was really struck by how a lot of these mainstream commentators now feel free to criticize Bush because he's at 30% in the polls, and I guess they feel like the repercussions will not be, you know, particularly great. But you know, a lot of them were saying, well, his domestic agenda's dead on arrival. He's going to have a tough time selling this Iraq policy, which seems to be more of the same. You know, so I think even his ability to kind of use the media as kind of a mouthpiece to get his message out is going to be restricted. I mean, you know, aside from kind of arms of the Republican Party like Fox News.
Well, it sounded in many ways just it was sort of pro forma. He had to say something. He, you know, he had to fill 50 minutes, so he did. But none of this looks like it has any future. And of course, the war in Iraq seems so dismal in terms of its prospect, other than creating more chaos, more death, more injury. You know, you can't cancel it, right? He couldn't do that, so he had to come up with something.
Well, it's interesting that he, you know, he made these noises about reaching across the aisle. Of course, his idea so far of reaching across the aisle is, you know, here's my plan. How do I get you to agree with it? You know, not really compromising. And he's continuing in that vein in terms of Iraq policy. I mean, he wouldn't even really adopt, you know, the bipartisan recommendations of the Baker-Hamilton Commission, which included such liberal stalwarts as Ed Meese, you know, the former Reagan Attorney General. So, you know, if he wasn't going to meet them partway, I don't know, you know, that he's going to meet the Democrats partway on either domestic or foreign policy issues. I mean, how much lower is he going to go? I think the only person who's had lower rate of approval was Nixon when he was about to get on a helicopter
going to leave the White House after Watergate.
How much of this on both sides, the Democrats, in terms of the legislation they've passed and what Bush has said last night when he spoke, is positioning for 2008? In other words, Bush says he's going to veto a lot of this, and that would allow the Democratic candidate finally, to say, look, this is what these guys are standing in the way of, and I mean, how the Republicans are positioning themselves is I don't even know if they are. I don't know if they have any position really to adhere to now.
Well, I think there's definitely going to be a continuing split. There's 21 senators on the Republican side up for re-election, and some of them have made the biggest noises about Iraq, people like Gordon Smith of Oregon. Now, whether they feel the need to do something beyond make noise is not clear yet, but I think Bush can't count on, the Republican caucuses on the Hill just moving in lockstep with him because they want to survive, in the electoral process. And hitching yourself to Bush was already viewed as a bad idea in the 2006 elections by a lot of the Republican candidates. I think it's going to be even more so in 2008.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. Bill Hartung, Senior Research Fellow at the World Policy Institute. I forgot to ask you ahead of time what your website is. We can direct people to that.
It's www.worldpolicy.org.
Okay. Bill Hartung, as usual, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Yes, thanks a lot.
This is WRIM.com.
I'm sorry. And it's been a while.
WRIM. The Rift.